Welcome to the Warrior Cat Wing of the Animation History Museum. I will be guiding your tour today. I hope you have nothing else planned. Warrior Cats is a book series that follows a society of feral cats who live in these groups that are kind of a mix between a gang and a cult. While they are considered kids' books, I will say Warrior Cats is less fun time happy cat adventures and more Watership Down. We won't be getting too graphic here, but a lot of the cats don't make it. Now, you might be wondering why these books have their own dedicated wing in the Animation History Museum. These are letters, not pictures, stupid. Well, you see, this fan base has the most animated fan base ever. Yes, even more than that one you really like. People love to draw these cats. Coming up is one of my favorite pieces. The artist's use of anime hair and Windows Movie Maker transitions perfectly encapsulates that indescribable era of 2009. And I especially love the artist's bold choice of including their OC into this piece, really calling to the essence of the human experience and that desire to rescue a villain who is also your comfort character. Something you need to understand is that kids who are now adults have been drawing these cats for quite some time. We have records of kids drawing these cats all the way back in 2004. And if you were a Warrior Cat fan during the 2008 housing market crash, then you were eating extremely well, not with food, but with edgy cat animations drawn entirely by a mouse. Fans were making anime openings, AMVs, and graphic depictions of some of the more Watership Down moments in the series. I'm blurring these out because mutilated cats bum me out. And just like the books that are still coming out, the warriors never stopped drawing. I don't want to sound dramatic, but you could spend the rest of your life watching nothing but Warrior Cat fan animations and still not have seen them all. I actually haven't done the math on that yet, but trust me, there's a lot. Is this playlist still going? I have been fully aware of the vast quantity of Warrior Cat fan animations for quite some time. Heck, I've even hired some of them. But I've never been able to truly enjoy a Warrior Cat fan animation, as I've never read these books growing up, because all the kids in my class who did pretended to be the cats during recess and would hiss at me whenever I tried talking to them, which even back then I was like, okay, this is a little weird, guys. But I regret not reading these books growing up, because now I'm left with all these unanswered questions. Why are so many people drawn to drawing these fictional cats? What are these feelings stirring in my bosom as I watch these? And why do the art styles change so much? As we move down the Warrior Cat fan animation timeline, around 2012 is when the Warriors really begin to specialize in multi-animator projects. Basically, there were so many people willing to draw these cats that a large group of them all worked together, each animating a different segment of a video, and then when everyone's segment gets done in 14 months, the finished segments get stitched together into one complete video. I guarantee you've seen at least one of these group reanimator projects before, and you might have the Warriors to thank for that. I don't know who started the trend. Maps work out great for everyone, because now you and 40 of your animation buddies only have to animate a few seconds of a cat fight, and we get to watch a super engaging music video with changing art styles every 6 seconds. I really have to commend everyone who puts these projects together, especially the ones that were done before messaging apps like Discord even existed. But what I find extremely impressive is that everyone who signs up for these projects are doing so simply for exposure. No one involved expects any type of monetary compensation, and Warrior maps are very often made to copyrighted music, meaning no one's making money off these projects anyways. I can only imagine what musicians must go through when their manager tells them, "You're not gonna believe this! Someone just made a fan-animated music video of your song on YouTube!" And then the artist goes to watch it, and they just see a bunch of cartoon cats fighting each other. Violently. Can I tell you a quick story time? Once I wandered into a Barnes & Noble and thought, I wonder if they have any physical copies of Warrior Cats, because that is something I am willing to buy. So I went to the young adult section, looked under W, and found nothing. They didn't have any. Well, that's too bad, I thought. I mean, between the main books, graphic novels, and super editions, there's only over 100 different books, with new ones still being written to this day, but I guess this BNN doesn't have any. Oh well. But then I had the disturbing realization that I might be looking in the wrong place. I was looking in the young adult section. I needed to extend my search to the kids' corner, spelled with a Z. So I gingerly walked from the kid book section to the little kid book section, trying to find the book I was currently reading. And there, next to the barn built into the wall and the blocks, were the Warriors. I'm not going to judge you on whatever books you like to read, because I live in a glass house. If I was ever going to understand what made people so drawn to drawing these violent feral kitty cats,
then I would have to start reading these. So, whether you never read these books but are curious to know why so many people are drawing the characters, or maybe you did read these books a long time ago and want a refresher from the perspective of an adult who didn't grow up with them. Either way, get your favorite cat treat and knock something off a counter as we dive paws first into the wild and wonderful world of Warrior Cats. So, spoiler warning for Warrior Cats.
Our main protagonist is Rusty, a handsome ginger Tom. Those are not my words.
That is how he's described in the character description at the front of the book. Ignore that he's called Firepaw right now. Firepaw and Rusty are the same cat. It'll make sense in a little bit.
Rusty is a regular house cat living with people, or as he would call them, two legs. You see, cats have some pretty unique slurs for everyday normal human things. This isn't a car driving on a road. It's a monster on the Thunderpath.
Personally, I love it when books explain everyday mundane human things from, like, a non-human perspective. Like, yeah, a car would be a monster to a cat. It merges without using a turn signal.
Now, our main cat, Rusty, grows tired of his soft kitty pet life and thinks maybe living in the forest directly behind his backyard would sorta kinda be cool. But he's not ready for a big life change just yet. But then one day, Rusty's only friend in the entire world named Smudge, he tells Rusty, "Hey, did you know when our owners take us to the vet, they chop our guys off?"
Fellas, would you spend the rest of your life surviving in the woods if it meant you got to keep both of your dudes? I would.
So, like many other unneutered male cats, Rusty abandons his soft kitty pet life and sets out to start a new, wild and free life in the forest directly behind his backyard.
It turns out there's a whole society of wild feral kitty cats living in the forest behind Rusty's backyard, and they've divided themselves into four distinct groups, or clans. The first clan we're going to be looking at is Thunder Clan. This is the clan our protagonists belong to and where most of the story takes place. These cats are the moral, compassionate, brave ones. Gryffindor. The next clan is Shadow Clan. These are the edgy, evil cats. Slytherin. Sure, there's evil cats in every clan, but a lot of them are from Shadow Clan, especially in Season 1. Because they have Shadow in the name, I always imagined every cat here was just a black Halloween cat. The next clan is River Clan. Their main thing is they swim. I wouldn't call them Ravenclaw because they're not smart. They're more of a water tribe. And the next clan is Wind Clan, but you don't need to worry. They're Hufflepuffs, so. Cats from different clans hate each other and are super territorial. Don't even think about falling in love and starting a family with a cat from a different clan. That is so unaccepted, it happens constantly. And those are the four clans in the forest. However, there's one clan not in the forest we need to talk about called Star Clan. Ooh. Did you know cats have their own religion? Your childhood cat isn't going to be kicking it with you in boring old two-leg heaven. They're going to be sharing tongues with their ancestors in Star Clan. Sharing tongues is like when cats lick each other, like, you know, normal cat behavior. But whenever I read sharing tongues, I always thought they were like French kissing or something. Star Clan is basically warrior cat heaven. And it's so much more than a character looking up at the night sky and seeing their deceased dad in the clouds. Instead, StarClan plays a much bigger role in the books, and we get to frequently visit and see what wacky antics the Cat Angels get up to. So even though there is a lot of death in Warrior Cats, just because a cat dies doesn't mean it's the last we'll ever see of them. They'll just be in their angel form from now on. And those are the five clans you need to know about. It's just those four main ones and Warrior Cat Heaven. There's not going to be, like, a secret sixth clan or anything. Now, normally, forest cats are super big on cat purity and would never allow this random outsider into their clan. But you see, the leader of ThunderClan, named Blue Star, she had a pretty good reason to allow this handsome ginger Tom into the clan. Blue Star, you know, kinda thought he was the chosen one. And he canonically still had both of his guys, so. Prophecies play a very big role in the wild world of Warrior Cats. And the first prophecy we hear about is fire alone will save the clan. So knowing that fire alone will save the clan, Blue Star sees this handsome Ginger Tom just wandering through the forest and officially accepts him into ThunderClan, bestowing him the new name, Fire Paw. See, that's why the front of the book called him Fire Paw, remember? Now it's making sense. So completely remove the name Rusty from your brain. That's never coming back. Everyone who's read these books knows this cat as Fire Paw. He's got a paw of fire. By this point, you've probably noticed a pretty unique formula to some of these cat names. Blue Star? Fire Paw? Let's take a look at some of these other characters, shall we? Let's see, we got Ashfur, Mousefur, Leopardfur, Frostfur, Russetfur, Oakfur, Brackenfur, Sootfur, Ashfur again? Okay, what the fur is going on? What's with all these war- If you are not privy to the naming convention of these warrior cat characters, the nomenclature of these cat names follows a simple two-part system. Every cat's name is made up of any of these prefixes and any of these suffixes. Can you see that? Graypaw, White Storm, Blue Star. Every name is like this. Mountain Dew is a valid warrior cat name. Now, I already knew about these ridiculous double-syllable names going into the series, and I was legitimately worried it would be impossible for me to keep track and remember all of these cat names. But do you want to know something I didn't know going into this series? Their name changes. When I got to the first name-changing ceremony, I threw the book down thinking, I'm not smart enough to understand the complexities of warrior cats. I should just give up. But then I thought, no. If a 9-year-old child in 2008 can remember all these ridiculous cat names, then so can I. And then I got to one of the many kit birthing scenes, and all the cats would go, oh boy, more warriors for ThunderClan. Everyone welcome Ice Kit and Fox Kit. And I would go,
I hope Ice Kit and Fox Kit die.
But I must say, once you really get into this series, remembering all the different cat names isn't that big of an issue. First of all, sometimes the cat's name will just be a short description of what they physically look like, ergo make them easier to remember. What do you think Running Nose looks like? What do you think Spider Legs looks like? I don't know what Mouse Fur looks like, but in my head, she's always wearing like a mouse costume. And just no one addresses it. They're just like, that's mouse fur. What's really bad is that there's like mouse fur and then mouse kit, like in the same scene. And it's like, what are we doing here, Aaron? And as strange as these names sound, there's actually a methodology to them that correlates to what rank a cat is. Kittens will always have the suffix kit. You read the sentence, Ice Kit and Fox Kit were playing in the hollow. You don't have to worry about them. They don't matter. Apprentices will always have the suffix paw, because they're apprentices. Fire paw and gray paw are both apprentices. And anything above them is when the warrior names get a little more creative and don't have a set suffix, except for the very top, the leaders, which always have the name Star. Which means you have to be careful reading the wiki, because sometimes learning a cat's up-to-date name is a spoiler. Now, instead of having to remember Gray Stripe, Blue Star, White Storm, all you really have to remember is Gray, Blue,
white.
And while we're looking at the clan hierarchy, can I just talk about medicine cats real quick? Medicine cats are responsible for healing the sick and injured clanmates, and they don't use, like, medicine. All of their healing comes from herbs found locally in the forest, but I always felt like the books were stretching some of the healing properties they claimed these herbs possessed. Okay, the cats are constantly getting into fights, so they're getting scratches, and the med cats would put cobwebs over wounds. Okay, I can sort of see that working as like a natural band-aid. But then, during one of the many kit birthing scenes, the med cats would be like, "Oh no, give her a poppy seed to calm her down!" And I was always like, a singular poppy seed? Like, from a bagel? At least give her, like, a couple.
So back in the forest, Rusty meets all the other Apparentices in ThunderClan. And one Apparentice confides in our hero some terrible news. He secretly witnessed this other cat named Tigerclaw murder another cat in his own clan.
Tigerclaw is here, and he murdered the cat here, the deputy, because deputies of a clan are next in line to be leader, so he couldn't just murder the leader, he has to murder the deputy so he could be deputy, and then he can murder the leader. Do you understand? Good. Okay, cool.
I just want to point out that I got this corkboard off Facebook Marketplace, and the pictures did not show how badly sun damaged it was.
So immediately, this series sets up Tigerclaw as the main bad guy of the story. That he's willing to murder cats in his own clan to become leader. And getting to become the leader of a clan is a very enticing idea to Tigerclaw, because leaders get blessed by StarClan with 9 lives. Every other cat only gets 1 life, but the leaders get to die 8 extra times.
And I really like this plot device, because as the series goes on, we get to keep track of how many times a leader loses a life, and the suspense builds and builds as we get closer to that final one. Now, our heroes kinda do everything in their power not to tell anyone that Tigerclaw is the bad guy. Like, there's seriously a scene where Firepaw gets a one-on-one training session with Blue Star, and he's like, "I should probably tell the leader of my clan about the broad-shoulder backstabbing murderer named Tigerclaw in the clan." But then Blue Star's like, "Fight me!" And then he gets caught up in the fighting, and then he just forgets to tell her. Okay. So just like the other characters, we're gonna keep the thought of Tigerclaw being the main bad guy in the back of our mind, because we got more important stuff to worry about. ShadowClan just attacked ThunderClan for no reason. Oh, fuck! And they end up killing Firepaw's secret crush, who he barely talked to and was way older than him and practiced celibacy.
The Thundercats and Shadowcats face off in a big epic battle, and eventually the heroic Thundercats defeat the evil Shadowcats.
And as the first episode comes to a close, Blue Star promotes Firepaw to the warrior class.
Firepaw's new warrior name is Fire Heart.
Alright, that's now 2 times our protagonist has changed names in 1 book.
Now that Fireheart is officially a warrior, I would like to take a quick palate-cleansing break from the wild world of warrior cats, because I would feel extremely remiss if I didn't share with you all a rather humorous story time about an instance where I, too, was trying to become a warrior.
So when I was deep into reading these books, I went to this boxing gym because I was training for nothing, apparently. And on my drive to said boxing gym, I would listen to the Warriors. It helped me get into the right headspace, I guess. Now, the way the parking lot at this gym worked was that sometimes you'd park your car in front of another car, and then you would give your keys to the receptionist guy at the front, and he would move your car for you. Totally fine, totally cool, except for the one time I made the mistake of leaving my phone in the car, a phone that would auto-connect and immediately play the last thing I was listening to if said car were to turn on. At any given moment, I'd like to think my social interaction skills are at a 7 out of 10. Pretty good, but still room for improvement. In the middle of a boxing class, I'm covered in sweat, I got stink lines coming off me, now I'm at a 6 out of 10. But when the boxing gym receptionist comes up to me and says, "Hey man, you left your phone in your car. By the way, love the book you're reading." Whoosh, now I'm at a 0. I've talked to this receptionist before, and he knew I did YouTube, so I tried desperately to explain myself. Oh, you know, I'm gonna make a video about it. Plus, I wanted to read more this year. And then he asks, are you gonna mention
the movie?
I was cut off by this. I knew there wasn't a Warrior Cats movie, but I was absolutely not going to argue about it with the boxing gym receptionist in front of a bunch of dudes punching each other. So I just went, there's a movie? And he goes, yeah, there's a movie. And the way he said, yeah, there's a movie, made it sound like I was the dumb one for not knowing about the Warrior Cats movie. And I forget exactly what I said after that, but it was probably along the lines of, could someone please punch me so I no longer have to be in this conversation? And for the whole rest of the class, I could not fathom why that guy was so positive about the existence of a movie that definitely didn't exist. Did he see someone reenact the entire book with Littlest Pet Shop Dolls and think that was a movie?
I'm sure gonna miss you, Ravenpaw.
Why don't we share tongues one last time?
It wasn't until I got back to my car when things started to click. When I turned my car on and connected my phone, the little dashboard screen thingy didn't say, now playing Warriors, The New Prophecy, Episode 5. All it said was now playing Twilight. So he thinks I was reading that, and I don't know which is worse.
So diving paws first back into the wild world of Warrior Cats, Fireheart's best bro for life, who is now named
Graystripe,
starts being a little horn cat. It's like horn dog, but it's a horn cat. He's being a little frisky boy.
You see, it all started when Graystripe accidentally fell into a river and was rescued by a cat in River Clan. And these two cats from different clans immediately hit it off. But this will just be the first example of one of the many universal truths about Warrior Cats. All it takes for two characters to fall deeply in love with each other is if they ever appear in a scene together. And that's especially true for cats from different clans. Something about betraying your whole clan is sexy, I guess. Meow.
Fireheart keeps his best bro's forbidden relationship a secret when all of a sudden, she's pregnant? And she's having the kits now? Graystripe's gonna be a dad?
Graystripe's girlfriend doesn't make it through kit birth, but luckily, her kids do. We have the boy one and the girl one. You don't have to worry about them ever again. This leaf blower is killing me. What do I do? What do I do about this leaf blower? Do I ask him to stop?
After this scene, Graystripe's forbidden relationship made a lot more sense to me. It felt rushed and contrived because this was never a love story. It was an I got the River Clan leader's daughter pregnant who then died in kit birth story. A classic tale for all children's books. This death was the first in the series that made me go, whoa, Warrior Cats don't mess around. Who kills off the pregnant girlfriend? And then Graystripe tries living in River Clan for a bit, but that ultimately falls through, so he doesn't get to live there anymore, and he never gets to see his two kids grow up. Well, his first two kids.
While Graystripe was going behind everyone's back to visit his River Clan girlfriend, Fireheart was going behind everyone's back to visit his biological sister at her Two Legs nest. And she tells him, you know, you're making the idea of living in the forest sound totally cool and awesome. I don't want to completely uproot my life, though, so could you take one of my kids away and force him to live with you? This is Cloudtail, Fireheart's sister's son. The books never call this white cat Fireheart's nephew. They always called him his sister's kit, sister's son, or sister's firstborn.
Now, this could just be because cats are quirky with words and don't have a name to describe the relationship of your sister's son. But the more the books kept avoiding ever using the word nephew, the more I started to worry that nephew was too big of a word for this reading level. But then the books throw the word jubilant at you? You're not gonna use nephew, but jubilant's fine? You seriously gonna make me pull out a dictionary, Warrior Cat? Since Cloudtail was thrown into clan life kind of against his will, he doesn't super respect the strict set of rules all the clan cats follow. And he's an atheist. just doesn't believe in Starkland, like, at all. That detail never really comes up, but the books let you know that he is one. It's super important that you know the religious views of these cats, okay? Cloudtail ends up getting captured by Two Legs, and now it's up to his mother's brother to rescue him. When this scene was first introduced, I got super excited because by now, so much of the drama in this series has been cats fighting over prey, cats fighting over territory, and cats fighting over love. So when the opportunity of a rescue my sister's son heist was introduced, I was excited just for something different. Fireheart's going to have to navigate through a two-leg nest he's never been in before and describe all the mundane human things he sees from his non-human cat perspective. What is this strange hissing elephant? I love it when books do that kind of stuff. But while I was thinking of all the interesting possibilities, Fireheart just opens the front door and Cloudtail escapes. He never even goes inside. Cool. Glad you're back, Cloudtail. You're gonna follow the strict set of rules, but still be an atheist? No, that's fine. Yeah, I think I saw some fresh kill we could hunt back there. Once our heroes were finally done dealing with their atheist nephew and pregnant girlfriend, they finally came to their senses and told the leader Blue Star about the murderous broad-shouldered Tiger Claw in the clan.
And it actually got to a point where I started to question if Tiger Claw really was the main bad guy.
Now, this might just be because I watch too many movies, but when something tries this hard to tell me he's the main bad guy, especially this early on in the story, I start to think, yeah, I can smell this plot twist coming from a mile away. Fireheart never had any proof Tiger Claw was evil. He was just blindly believing what this other random apprentice was saying. Tiger Claw was there when Cinderpelt got her legs run over, but we don't know for sure he caused the accident. How does a cat even orchestrate something like that? Yeah, he might be constantly giving off bad vibes, but that's just all part of the misdirection. I'm telling ya, there's enough wiggle room here for this cat to actually be the misunderstood good guy. But it turns out, no. He is evil, and he did all those evil things. Tiger Claw, what is this? Blue Star's meow was sharper now, edged with anger, not fear. I'm the leader of your clan. I'm the leader of your clan. Or have you forgotten that? Not for much longer, Tiger Claw growled. I'm going to kill you, and kill you again, as many times as it takes for you to join StarClan forever. It wasn't until I read that exact line when I started to think, okay, Tiger Claw is for sure the main bad guy. I thought it was ambiguous this whole time, but no, he's the bad guy, he's bad.
So the villain of the story turned out to be a character I wasn't expecting to be the villain, making Tiger Claw, at least for me, an untwisted twist villain.
So Tiger Claw is exiled from the camp, and since Blue Star no longer trusts anyone else in the camp, except for Fireheart, she promotes him to clan deputy. Meaning, at the start of the series, Fireheart was here, below everyone in the clan, and by the end of episode 3, he's already here, second in command. Next in line to be leader.
But the cherry on top, this terrible news cake, is that our main bad guy, Tiger Claw, isn't done doing main bad guy things. Shadow Clan just made some pretty significant changes to the clan hierarchy.
Our main bad guy, Tiger Claw, who is the biggest proponent of cat purity, by the way, switches teams and becomes the new leader of Shadow Clan.
He finally got his wish of becoming leader and getting 9 lives. We're dealing with Tiger Star now. Then Tiger Star sets a pack of wild dogs loose in the ThunderClan camp, and they end up killing random background characters.
It's one of those wild feral dogs that kill cats and tear off faces. Oh, it's so the horror! I'm getting attacked by a dog! Ah! Oh, wait, I'm wearing makeup. Maybe you should.
The dogs chase Fireheart off a cliff and into some rushing water, and right as the light begins to fade from his eyes, Blue Star swoops in and rescues him.
But I guess that used up the last of her energy because, in a horrible twist of fate, She's now dying. And it's her last life, by the way. I've been keeping track.
This one's for you, Blue Star.
Okay, so she's out of the picture. Fireheart, the current clan deputy, becomes the new leader of ThunderClan, which also means he's going to change name.
His new name is Firestar. All right? It's not Fireheart or Firepaw, and it's certainly not Rusty. This is Firestar. This will be the last time that he changes names. It's physically impossible for him to change names again.
Unfortunately, this moment was spoiled for me. I always knew that Rusty would be the leader of ThunderClan because while I was researching this video, I remembered this classic fan animation I saw ages ago about Fireheart not liking waffles.
Oh, waffle time, it's waffle time. Will you have some waffle mine?
So I watched this video again for entirely research purposes and was horrified to see the video was actually called Firestar Doesn't Like Waffles. This video was a pretty big spoiler for me. So Tiger Star and Fire Star are now both topped to the nines new lives. If we're ever going to defeat Tiger Star, he's going to have to be eliminated 9 times. Voldemort only needed 8 times. It's going to be a race of cat and cat to see who will be the last cat to lose their final life. And with the amount of books that are still in the series, I could see their rivalry lasting a really, really long time. Until this series goes in a direction that I think I should mention spoiler warning again, because wow. If you're at all familiar with this story and know what's about to happen, I bet you've just been dying for me to get to this part. To help accomplish his destroy Firestar by any means necessary plan, Tiger Star teams up with Blood Clan? Here's my mood board for the secret sixth clan that's been here this whole time. These are the extremely tough city cats. They live in the city that we've never heard of before. They don't have strange double syllable names or believe in a star clan, but they still call themselves a clan and have a clan leader for some reason. The leader of Blood Clan is Tiny. He's this tiny little black cat that wears a dog teeth collar. And he's a fan favorite. That's what all of this has been building up. You see? Scourge, Scourge, Scourge. I'm Scourge. I already pointed to myself. I know I've been doing a lot of Harry Potter references throughout this video, but I don't think there's a single Harry Potter character that best encompasses who this cat is. I think the best fictional character I can make a comparison to is Shadow the Hedgehog. So how are they going to fight two evil clans that formed an alliance? Well, the thing is, Tiny Little Scourge betrays Tiger Star and murders him in front of everyone. But that's okay. He's got 9 lives, remember? Wait, what's happening? Again, the massive tabby's body grew still for a heartbeat. But again, the wound was too terrible to yield to the healing trance. His claws tore up clumps of grass in his agony, while his screeches turned from fury to terror. This is a kid's book. He's dying 9 times! Holy sh**, said Firestar.
Tiny Little Scourge kills Tiger Star so badly that he dies, resurrects, and then dies again 9 times. So the villain of the story turned out to be a character I wasn't expecting to be the villain. They got me twice!
Initially, I was in denial. No, Tiger Star canonically had 9 lives. He can't die instantly to a cat we just met. This scene had me so flabbergasted that I had to reach out to someone. And everyone I talked to about it was always like, oh, you mean Scourge? I love Scourge. Scourge is so cool. And then I thought, okay, if this cat is so beloved, I should at least give him a chance. Maybe this whole time, the books were actually setting up how evil and ruthless this Scourge guy is. You thought that cat was the main bad guy? This new guy just killed him with barely any effort. This also sets up that Firestar's brand new 9 lives are essentially worthless because this new cat can just kill you and have you instantly burn through all 9 of them. Well, not instantly. Slow and painfully. which is definitely worse.
All right. It's a little unconventional, but if this is how the series sets up the actual main bad guy, then let's do it. Scourge, you've won me over.
When Scourge and Firestar face off for control over the whole forest, Scourge very easily kills Firestar, because of course he does. Firestar is just a random kitty pet who stumbled his way up the clan hierarchy. And this is Scourge. Ultimate life form Scourge.
Firestar
dies.
Except this time, when Scourge kills a clan leader, he only loses once. One life. He only dies once because of the power of friendship or something. I think it's a metaphor for Jesus, actually, and I'm not making that up. Unlike Tiger Star, Fire Star successfully, I'm sorry, fellas, I'm keeping you away from your, like, friends and family. Fire Star successfully resurrects, and Scourge is very understandably caught off guard by this because he's never seen a cat do that before. So this time when they face off, it goes a little like this. And that's how season one of Warrior Cats ends. As you know, we frequently get to visit and see what wacky antics the cat angels get up to in Cat Heaven. And while Tiger Star's ghost makes a pretty prevalent comeback, basically becoming the new Cat Satan, we never get to see Scourge or his spiky collar ever again. How is a cat who only shows up in this much of the story, kills the main bad guy, and then leaves and never comes back this beloved? It's because he's the ultimate life form, baby. If the only knowledge of warrior cats you have is from what I've told you in this video, while you do know more than the average person about warrior cats, you're still probably not going to understand what most of these fan animations are really about, because we only looked at 6 books out of like 100, and you don't know what the characters actually look like. I've just been showing you Garfield characters. However, my dear viewer, I really wanted to get the full Warrior Cat experience. So I read season 4. This is 4. Shit. I've read season 2, season 3, and season 4. Really just trying to get the full Warrior Cat experience. Season 4 seemed like a good stopping point. I also forgot to mention, I read the Super Editions too. There's like 27 books. 27 books. I've read 27 books this year. Get on my level. I didn't want to do all of them. I'm not crazy, okay? I'm in a padded room. I'm not crazy. So, with me as your local Warrior Cat expert, I can safely say I still have no clue what most of these fan animations are about. It's not my fault that I don't understand these. Most of the things that these people are animating aren't even canon. They've just been animating fanfiction this whole time. Cleopatra takes a character who's not even that prevalent and imagines her as an Egyptian Sphinx cat who has, like, no ties to Egypt at all in the books. Next up forever, what if Firestar and Scourge switched lives? And Firestar was the one with the spiky collar. Holyphon, all right, this one's got a giant snake monster in it. Mr. Fear asks the question, what if there was a zombie outbreak in Warrior Cats? Scavengers of the Wind, this one's also got a zombie theme going on and is genuinely the most terrifying Warrior Cat animation I've ever seen. I was legit watching this on my TV and I had to turn it off halfway through because it was so terrifying. I don't want to talk about it anymore. It took me reading almost 30 books to finally understand that Warrior Cat fan animations aren't meant to be understood. It seems like people just like drawing cats. But why is that?
Now, I actually have 5 different reasons why I think people are so drawn to drawing these cats. And the first reason is because cats are just fun to draw. Think about it this way. Would you rather spend years studying human anatomy, toiling away for hours trying to get the fingers right, or would you rather just draw a dumb little cat with a new woo face? Reason number 2 is the expansive world. This is the official Warrior Cats family tree. There's quite a few characters that I skipped over. I once heard someone describe Warrior Cats as Game of Thrones for kids, and while I've never seen or read any Game of Thrones,
I totally agree with that sentiment. It's even got the incest and everything. Since there are so many characters and little mini-adventures, it's very easy for someone to have a favorite character or moment that they can connect with, regardless of how prevalent they are in the story. And the third reason I think people are so drawn to drawing these cats is the lack of official art at the time. These days, Warrior Cat fans have official graphic novels that they get to look at, and I do own them, but I keep lending them out to people, so that's my bad. But in the early 2010s, all fans had to go off of were words and their imaginations, which I think made people more inclined to draw out their favorite moments in the series, regardless of how graphic and gory they were. In fact, the kids really like drawing the graphic and gory stuff. That's a conversation for another time. The fourth reason I think people like drawing these cats is how this series is perfectly set up to be a fandom.
Is that what it says?
Perfectly. That's hilarious. Creating your own Warrior Cat OC with a tragic backstory and a unique double-syllable name is not only very easy to do, but it's actually encouraged by the books themselves. At the back of some of these books is this, like, fully plotted out Warrior Cat D&D campaign inviting readers to pretend to be the cats. I always thought the kids during recess who pretended to be the cats were just very devoted fans, but they were just following the instructions the books clearly laid out for them. And the last reason I think people like drawing these cats is because their passion is infectious. I highly recommend you go down the same Warrior Cat fan animation rabbit hole that I did, because what you'll find is thousands of dedicated fans all creating art of their favorite book series. And they're not doing it for money or for views, but because they're passionate. And there's also like a bunch of videos that are over 15 years old, and that just makes me nostalgic for that early era of YouTube. I went into this video trying to understand what it was about this series that made people want to draw the cats. But the funny thing is, I ended up drawing these cats too. It's a virus. These cats are so drawable. I initially got my start online creating webcomics. It's something I enjoy doing. I love thinking of a joke, doodling it out, and sharing it with the world. That's my passion. And I guess seeing all of these passionate artists creating these fan animations looked like a whole lot of fun. And the fact that the main character is a ginger male cat, come on, that's just too perfect of an opportunity to do a Garfield reference. I don't think anyone's ever done that before. So, me and my team created 40 Garfield-inspired Warrior Cat webcomics, and we posted them every Wednesday. And even though we didn't make any money off of them, I really enjoyed making them and posting them every Wednesday. And not to get too vulnerable here, I know these are just Garfield comics, but they really helped me find my passion in creating art again. So thank you all for reading them. I hope you enjoyed. So if you're someone that's missing a little passion in your life, try watching hours of Warrior Cat fan animations. They're a whole ton of fun to watch. They do get a little violent at times, so, you know, be aware of that. And if you're someone that's ever produced a Warrior Cat fan animation, thank you for inspiring others to follow their passions. And if anyone on the Aaron Hunter team is watching, I hope you know you've made a lot of kids furries. That's all I'll say about that. Thank you all for watching. Have a good night, and I'll see you next time. Thank you all for joining me in this deep dive into the wild world of Warrior Cats. I know this is a pretty different video than I usually post. I had my face in it for a lot more than I usually do, but this video still took a long time to make because I read all of these books, and there was a period of time where I thought I could talk about all four seasons of Warrior Cats, but then the script was just way too long, and I thought season one was good enough on its own to be its own dedicated video. If you like this video, let me know, and I can do more Warrior Cat videos. Thank you all for watching. I hope you enjoyed, and wear your seatbelt. Yeah, I'm 25. That's a quarter of a century. And I've been doing YouTube full-time for a nickel of a century. My life's practically over. I'm at a point now where when people recognize me, they'll say, OMG, James, I've been watching you since the 8th grade. And I'll be like, OMG, your beard is bigger than mine. So I've been thinking,
You know those going through puberty videos your 8th grade science teacher shows you for some reason? The ones that are like, "Hey boys, I'm the puberty platypus, and I'm here to tell you that your body is going through some wonderful changes. You're gonna start growing hair in weird places, and smelling bad, but that's just the wonders of life." And then for the girl one, it's like, "Oh, ladies, you're gonna want to sit down for this one." Well, I think they need to make a puberty part 2 video that they show to high school seniors and prepare them better for the quote-unquote adult life they're about to face. Schools just give you a piece of paper and a funny hat and send you off into the world expecting you to figure out your intricate and complicated life through what? Trial and error? I want the puberty part 2 video that I'm planning on making to start like this. The puberty platypus will come back on screen and will be like, "Well, kids, you did it. See? Puberty wasn't so bad. For some of you. Unfortunately, dear children, this is only the beginning." And then he'll start talking about all the fun things you can expect in the following years. Like, instead of growing hair in new places, for some of you, your hair is going to start thinning and falling out. And if you're a guy worried about hair loss, then I've got good news. This video is sponsored by Bald People. They're paying me money to tell you to just shave it all. Shave it. Looking good, Rush! You're also going to be perpetually tired. And before you start thinking, "I'm not going to be tired, I'm going to get 8 hours of sleep every night." First of all, no you're not. And second of all, that's not going to help. You will still be tired, and there's no escape. Why do you think adults say, "Ha ha ha, don't talk to me till I've had my coffee"? It's because every adult, from the moment they wake up, is dead tired. And we need stimulants just to function. You're also going to start getting excited about things you used to think were stupid, like furniture shopping. Sometimes you'll go on Zillow and look at the most expensive houses and think, "Oh, that's a nice kitchen backsplash," and then wonder where your youth went. Another thing, 90% of the mail you get is worthless, but the other 10% of mail is very, very important. Like, if you ignore it, your water, power, and Wi-Fi get shut off. Important. Or you'll get mail that's like, "Hey, you owe the government some money, and we know how much money you owe us, but we're not going to tell you, stupid. So you either have to figure that out yourself, or pay another person some money so they can tell you how much money you owe the government." Hey there. I don't want you to be scared of growing up. There's still plenty of pros that come with being older. And also, you can't escape it. You'll get to be independent and make your own decisions. Did your parents never let you get a tattoo? Well, now you can. But I'm going to put it somewhere that I can easily cover it up when I visit them for Christmas. That way it's not weird if I exclusively wear turtlenecks around them. I just like them. Another pro, you won't complain about the food you have at home because you'll only ever buy the food you like and can afford. You're independent now. You can eat cake for breakfast. However, if you do that, your stomach will hurt and you won't be able to move for 8 hours. Okay, at first you'll be able to get by with bagel bites for dinner. That's a standard college-grade meal. But after a couple of years of that abuse, your body will go, "Yo, do you think you could throw down some, I don't know, fruit every once in a while? Yeah, we gotta make, like, new cells for your developing brain, and we've been making them solely out of bagel bites." It is genuinely upsetting that I have to figure out what I have to eat 3 times a day. There are some days where I'm hungry, but I'm not craving anything, and I know I have to eat, but I'm looking through my fridge, and I end up eating string cheese and grapes for lunch. On a bagel. I wish I could just unhinge my jaw and eat a month's worth of food like a snake. Do snakes only eat once a month? I don't know, I hate snakes. 50% of my driving destinations is to the grocery store, and the other 50% is drive-thrus. It's all food-based. Oh, actually, sometimes I do have to go to the gas station. Wait, that's just food for my car. I've been trying to eat out less, so I bought boxed frozen orange chicken instead of going to Panda Express. But then I realized, I'm still eating out, I'm just heating up the orange chicken in my own microwave. Some of you might like cooking. I don't. Whenever I cook a meal, I purposely cook way more food than I need so I can get 2 meals out of only cooking one. I would rather eat progressively staler pasta all week than have to cook every day. But even if you like cooking, I know one aspect of it you don't like, cleaning up the mess afterwards. Why do you think the rule, "I cooked it, you clean it," exists? And now that you're an adult, you're about to learn, It never stops. Get used to doing the dishes and laundry, because as long as you eat and sweat, those are two chores you do until the grave. Laundry is such a prevalent chore that I guarantee someone watching this video needs to put the wash into the dryer, but instead they're watching YouTube. Well, go on. Leave. I don't know how I'm going to handle folding dishes and cleaning laundry for the rest of my life. I'm only 25 and already burned out from it. Hey, speaking of burnout, I want to talk about something I just learned recently called having a healthy work-life balance. Some of you might have started working from home this last year. Welcome to the club. You now have no reason to go outside. So take it from a guy who's been working from home for 5 years. Go outside anyway. There's definitely benefits to working from home. Like, you get to work in your pajamas and... But it can be tough to work and live under the same roof, and I think a lot of young people have this mindset of being on the grind is a good thing, or at least a normal one. While it is important to work hard to achieve your goals, you need to be aware of burnout. And as a content creator who is his own boss, it's very easy to fall into an unhealthy work ethic. If you think your boss is annoying, try having a boss that lives inside your head and will not shut up about working. It could be Saturday and you're hanging out with your friends and your boss in the back of your head will say, you could be working. There will always be work that needs to be done. You will always feel anxious about not posting. And since you technically live in the office, you could theoretically work well into the early hours of the morning every night. Or morning, I don't know. I want to talk more about burnout and my YouTube journey and how I'm managing it, but that will be for another time because I've been working on it. I'm definitely getting better. I'm more relaxed on the weekends and going to more social settings. Vaccinated, of course. It's taken me a while to learn the importance of a healthy work-life balance and that it's okay to work on yourself. I'm not sure if you all related to that last part. Maybe give it a couple of years. But anyways, growing up is a part of life. Adulthood is something that you all should be looking forward to. You learn and experience so many things, and that's just your early 20s. And before I go, is there anything you want to add, Puberty Platypus? Am I ever going to find something I'm truly passionate about? I drift through every day doing what feels like nothing, seeing all my high school friends getting married and starting families, doing things that they're happy and excited about. It makes me feel even more isolated in my state of confusion and solitude. Who am I? Why don't I know myself anymore? What went wrong? Bagel Bite? I have never played Fortnite, but we're going to be playing a lot of it today, so buckle up. If I am going to get cracked, then I should probably download the game. Wait, what's an epic launcher? I just want to play Fortnite. Luckily, this endeavor won't break the bank because Fortnite is a free game. Really? I get to experience all of this for free? Today, we're going to be playing 100 games of Fortnite to see if we can actually improve, develop a skill, and try and earn that elusive victory royale. I mean, we're not playing Fortnite. I'm playing Fortnite. You're watching a YouTube video. Now, before we get into any games, let's first... Alright, I'm just going to go with my standard username, no big deal, and... Oh. Okay, yeah, that one's probably on me. The game's been out for 7 years, so I hope whoever has that account has been earning me a lot of dubs and make me look good. Okay, I guess we should keep a low profile. We don't want to get stream sniped, you know? So after hours of brainstorming, I settled on the name GatorGuy333, because I'm the GatorGuy333. There are two popular modes to play Fortnite. There's the classic Battle Royale mode with all the features and doodads that made the game as popular as it is, like doing this. And then there's Zero Build, where there's none of that shit. Now, which mode is the more competitive mode? Whichever mode I'm playing. For my very first game, I decided to play the classic Battle Royale mode, baby. We're playing Fortnite like how God intended. Builds on, ranked off, skin default. What, you think I'm gonna buy a skin? You think I'm gonna spend money on a free game? Pfft, get out of here. Oh my god, is that Peter Griffin? Alright, enough talk. Let's start. I would like to remind you that I'm playing Fortnite for the very first time.
Who's shooting me? Oh, God.
I didn't have a friend on call to tell me what buttons to press or give me emotional support. Like, no one told me, hey, don't drop that mythic gun for shield blasters. Shield blasters aren't even that good. Also, my go-to video games are Mario Maker and Tetris. I'm not really a first-person kind of shooter. What do you mean it's technically a third-person shooter? Who are the other two people? Instead of doing all of these unnecessary side quests, right now, my one and only quest is to be the best and not rest until I conquest all the sweats.
Do I take fall damage in this game?
Don't worry, Past James. You'll find out soon enough. I landed in fencing fields, and the second my feet touched the ground, I started getting shot at. I went inside a building and started breaking random objects, hoping that there was a gun inside them.
This is horrible sound.
And I grabbed a rare Striker AR. The very first gun of my Fortnite career and it's already a rare? Let's go, dude. But then I found an uncommon shotgun just lying on the floor, and I had to pick which gun I was going to take to battle because my inventory was already full of priceless items. I decided to keep my rare gun because it had more bullets and because I like the color blue more than green. So,
can I only hold one gun, or is it like my inventory is full? Who am I talking to? Oh! Ah! You stood no chance, bro. You stood no chance.
In that moment, I had gotten what I thought was my very first Fortnite kill. This, however, was not another player, but rather one of the many NPCs just wandering around the map. But I didn't know that at the time, so there was nothing but pure joy on my face. Almost immediately, I got a second Fortnite kill, and my suspicions that these were actually computer players were growing.
Is this a bot? Why can't I? They like didn't hurt me at all.
I started shooting what looked like a final boss, but had run out of bullets. Uh-oh. I ran away, narrowly dodging every shot being fired at me. I healed up, found another gun, tried shooting the boss again, ran out of bullets again, and then I ran away again. Hey, that's two confrontations where I didn't die. Clearly, I'm a natural. I knew I had to get away from the danger, so I started building a ramp.
And like, we're building a staircase. Ah! Oh, God! No! No, that's how it happened? That's how I went out?
So, yes, there is fall damage in Fortnite. You know what? Build mode sucks. Build mode's what killed me. We're done doing that. We're doing no build from now on. Now, before we get into game two, I would like to briefly explain some of the fundamentals I learned from playing that I wish someone explained to me. Starting with the guns are going to be your main tool for killing. And every gun has a rarity assigned to it, ranging from common, uncommon, rare, epic, mythic, and legendary. Those last two might be switched. Actually, I never knew which adjective was better. But either way, orange and yellow guns are more rare than rare guns, and more epic than epic ones. I'm sorry if you already know this, okay? This is just how I process things. Okay, I have to make a YouTube video about it. An uncommon sniper rifle could have the best scope in the game, while an epic one could have no scope at all. The epic sniper will do more damage and have a faster reload time, but if you can't hit anyone due to a lack of scope, which gun's actually better? Doesn't matter for me, I still couldn't hit anyone regardless. Also, this is an Overwatch 2. You have a limited amount of ammo, which in the early game is something you really have to be mindful of. I learned that my first day.
Am I out of... I'm out.
You'll just have to play the game to figure out which guns click with you, but my favorite guns are shotguns. And I have the data to back it up. The damage they do, as well as you not even needing good aim to do damage, make them a great choice for getting kills.
Fun! I'm having fun!
Unfortunately, you can't just go walking around with every shotgun you find. You only have 5 inventory slots that you have to use wisely. And you'll want to save at least 2 of those slots for a healing item and a specialty item. So really, you should only be going around with a maximum of 3 guns. But I'm not here to backseat game, alright? You can do whatever you want. It's a free game. Okay, enough explaining. Let's get back to match. I landed in fencing fields and immediately started getting shot at again. Not a super great start, I know.
How did you get a weapon so fast?
I found a gun, but with three other people shooting me, I decided my best option was to hide in a dumpster, which turned out to be a terrible hiding spot because the boss lady found me in 5 seconds. And for the next 4 minutes, I grabbed any gun or grenade I could find and started using them on all the grunts shooting me. And I was slowly starting to pick them off.
What's up? What's up, guys? How's it going? How many kills is this? One?
I was gaming so hard that I didn't even realize that this right here was my first actual Fortnite kill. XXX Dark Tonics XX. I'm sorry I had to do it to you, but you were the first player I ever eliminated. I hope knowing this fact makes you feel a sense of pride and accomplishment in me. My KD ratio is now perfectly balanced, so that's good. I took a moment to figure out the controls, and I started taking down some more players.
Let me see if I can, zoom in. Okay, I can crouch. Nope, that's... Oh, okay. Is there, a... Oh, if I hold... Oh, that's how I do it. What are you? Rare, and you have 30... Oh, wait, my other gun had 105 bullets.
With the boss eliminated, I opened a vault with a key card and found 2 epic guns and a rocket launcher. Also, on the way to the vault, I may or may not have dropped a mythic gun for some shield blasters. Thankfully, no one saw, so that would have been embarrassing.
Where's Tilted Towers? What? Who is that?
A giant floating island appeared in the sky, and I decided to head up it.
See ya!
In the middle of the island, I started to capture a flag, and when I successfully captured it, I was rewarded with even more mythic guns that I didn't pick up for some reason. I'm sorry, rewatching this footage is just as painful for you as it is for me, okay?
Supersonic racing. Everybody was supersonic racing. Come on, load! Dude, I don't want to count any chickens or anything, but are we doing this?
I saw the storm closing in, and then I noticed...
Oh, there's only 2 people! It's me and one other guy!
And then this amazing clutch happened.
Okay, load. Where'd you go? Where is she? There she is. What do I do now?
Well, that just happened. My second game ever, and I already got a dub? Oh, you? Well, all of you astute, sweaty Fortnite players watching might have noticed that my final opponent kinda sucked ass. I mean, look at him. We're both in a completely open area, and this player can't even land a single hit on me. And they made it into the top 2? That's because... No matter how good you are at Fortnite, after every round, there's 1 winner and 99 losers. And if every player has an equal chance of winning, that would mean you're still losing 99% of the time. And if you were playing a video game where you lost 99% of the time, you would probably stop having fun and never play the game again. Or not, I don't know, I've never played Dark Souls. So what Epic Games does to remedy this is they fill up every match with bots who kind of suck shit. This way, you can get some easy kills on other players and make it further into every game. At least you got 3 kills in 20th place, right? That doesn't feel as bad as getting 99th. However, the unintended consequence of this is that now, after every kill you get, there's a little thought in the back of your head thinking, did I actually kill someone with a soul, or is Fortnite going easy on me? So there's a pretty big chance that my first Fortnite kill, XXX Dark Tonic XXX, wasn't even a real person that could feel proud of me. Chances are, none of these other players are real.
Here are my opponents.
Eventually, we'll be at a high enough level where it'll start to feel like, a challenge. We're just gonna keep trucking along. Let's start
No. Okay. Oh, I'm out. Cool. Hello?
Okay, I guess we'll chalk up those last 2 games to beginner's luck. Surely things will go differently in Matt.
A cabbage and a coconut. Cool. Let me just bite into that. And shotgun and shotgun and shotgun. Made me waste all my ammo, dude. Okay, anyone at all? Hello? Too easy! Too!
Technically speaking, no one has killed me yet. At least in match 2, I was the one who eliminated the last player, but matches 3 and 4 just handed me a crown on a fluffy pillow. You know, I wanted to do this really cool thing where we looked at spreadsheets and tracked my progress, but all the data's gonna get kinda messed up if I just keep winning all the time. Why learn the game or develop a strategy if everything I'm doing results in a win? It's upsetting that I'm already perfect. I hope this is still a good idea for a video. We still have a whole lot more Fortnite to get through, so let's just see if we can stumble and fumble our way into even more victory.
Ah! Ah! Oh, this is what loss feels like.
I think those 3 wins in a row made me a little cocky. I mean, no one has been able to stop me, so I wasn't trying anything special. When I saw another player, I would just do my normal strategy of standing still and shooting, and it got me 15th place. But this does prove that I can be stopped. Finally, we've faced a worthy opponent. Sheeny Shear. F*** you, Sheeny Shear. Oh well, I guess we couldn't win them all. I mean, I still have more wins than losses at this point. As long as the next 50 games go well, then I won't be complaining.
I was looking at the map, bro!
How do I thank the bus driver? I would love to thank them, but I unfortunately do not know the button to thank them.
Gee!
I don't know what this is, but I'm afraid to use it.
I don't know what that does! I don't know what that does! Whoa, 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 whoa!
No.
Oh boy. Oh no! Ooh. Oh, oh, please don't, please don't. Oh,
one of these days we're gonna learn how to thank the bus driver.
$99.
Oh, you're not f***ing around?
Well, me neither. I don't know what I'm doing, you guys.
Wish I knew how to thank the bus driver.
The guy, oh,
what is this? Medallion. Cool. I want you.
Look at the camera, floof.
Camera's right there, floof.
What the? What just happened?
I was in the middle of a grind. How come when I shoot people, it takes like 4 or 5 hits? I'm starting to get in heated gamer moments. Am I just bad at the game? Oh, I am bad at the game.
Whoa! Oh, oh!
What is this? How do I get you here? You got me.
Cool.
B?
Oh! It's B! That was bad, that was bad, that was bad.
This match I started doing pretty well in.
We can't keep doing this. We can't.
I landed in Pleasant Plaza and got 3 kills without taking any damage.
We got the jump on him.
I started getting even more kills and was picking up some pretty good loot. I even picked up these 3 medallions, not knowing what they did. And before I knew it, there was only me and one person left.
There's only one person left?
This hadn't happened since those first 3 games, which I frankly didn't deserve to win.
Where are you?
I was upset, yes, but I can accept when I've been outplayed.
How did that happen?
In this match, I got my first and only kill with a cluster clinger right at the very start. Overall, I was able to get 9 kills this match, There were a lot of close calls in this game, but I was always able to find health packs and heal back up. As long as I stayed in the storm circle, I was going to let the other players come to me. And my patience paid off because once again, I ended up in the top two and I started to get nervous.
Oh, fiddlesticks.
No, 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 no.
I made some dumb mistakes. Like, once again, not picking up those legendary guns that were on the ground. What? I only got 3 kills this match, but I made it to the top 3 with a legendary run-and-pump shotgun. If you've played Fortnite, you know this is the most superior shotgun out of all the shotguns. I saw the last 2 players fighting by the storm, and instead of waiting for them to kill each other, I sniped Banana Joe 934 from afar. I was in second place yet again, but this time I had the last player in my sights.
Where are you? Where are you? I know about that running over people trick.
No! Ooh. I want to talk about the top 2 jitters. Dude, I can't describe how anxiety-inducing it is being one of the last 2 players alive. You have narrowly survived every challenge and bot thrown at you for the last 20 minutes, and now the only thing that stands between you and a victory royale is the best player in the game. Getting into the top 2, I would literally be shaking and making mistakes that I couldn't afford to make. With so many close games, I decided to call it a night, and as my head rested on my pillow, I only had one question on my mind. How? By this point, Fortnite had started to slip into my subconscious. I was having dreams about Fortnite. One time I was lying in bed and I heard this sound. And I thought, there's someone nearby. I need to kill them. I pretty much got the gist of Fortnite. I had been to all the places on the map, I knew what every gun did, but I couldn't get over the second place hump. I needed to elevate my Fortnite skills. I needed to consult the Is anyone going to interrupt me? No? Look, not getting outside help was never part of the challenge, okay? Is it fair that everyone else already knows the buttons when I didn't even know what button used the scope? How am I supposed to know that? No one ever told me you can pick up the business turret after it's been thrown. And I'll never be able to pick them up. Here is the official guide to Fortnite. It's full of useful information like telling me where Tilted Towers or Loot Lake is. Oh, here's something. Surviving the endgame. It says you need to prepare to improvise. To survive this phase of the game, you'll want to have a few structures you can build. Okay, maybe this won't be helpful. Ah, here we go. You can claim a victory royale without building a single structure in the game, but you'll need sharp reflexes and to be able to move deftly to pull it off. Okay, so skill issue is what the official guidebook says. I was kind of hoping for some, I don't know, useful strategies. Something like, here's a link to an aimbot. So I decided to ask a real human for some help, and my friend Rush told me, hey, did you know there's a setting you can turn on that lets you visually see what direction noises are coming from? What? So now, even if my ears can't actually hear footsteps, the game will tell me, hey, there's footsteps to your right. Someone is definitely nearby. Now, this setting is for hearing impaired people, so is me using this setting as an able-bodied hearing man cheating, kind of? Yeah, kind of. But I need every bit of help I can get, and I bet most of you play with this setting on too, and you hear just fine. Now let's see if we can apply this useful tool as we head into Oh, I have some bad news. I don't normally work with external hard drives, so I didn't realize these things were made out of eggshells. I was storing all of my footage on an external hard drive, and I guess I forgot to put it on its tiny pillow or something, because after I stored over 300 gigs worth of footage onto it, it stopped working. I took it to a data recovery specialist, and they quoted me $950 to repair it. Oh boy, I mean, I gotta go for it. The stuff on this hard drive's priceless. But then they were like, actually, there's nothing we can do, idiot, loser. You see these pictures we sent you? That means it's too damaged beyond repair. What were you doing to this hard drive? Were you throwing it on the ground? Were you hitting it with a hammer? So, unfortunately, we will never get to see games 63 through 99. Hey, are you crying?
No. Who are you?
I am your fairy Fortnite godmother. I'm here to help you.
Are you going to use magic to fix my hard drive?
What? Do you think I have magical powers?
I don't... Yes?
Magic can't change the fact that you saved all of your important, irreplaceable footage onto a single hard drive, stupid. But luckily, my child, you don't need any magic. You have Fortnite Reaper. Did you know that Fortnite automatically saves your last 50 or so matches as a replay file that you can go back and watch later? This is a miracle! Because of replay files, we didn't lose any gameplay footage. We did, however, lose the webcam, so you won't get to see my live reaction or witty commentary during any of these games, which sucks, I know. I did this whole bit where I kept losing, so I became a sweat.
We're cracked! We're cracked! We're going!
But I'm just happy we're able to recover any gameplay footage at all, and I've also learned to back everything up. So with that little hiccup taken care of, how did I do with visual sounds turned on? Well, let's take a look at match...
Boom. He's gone. Ooh. Take that medallion, and there's a bunch of legendary guns, and I actually grab two of them. Two legendary guns. Circle real small. And then... Victory Royale. Very anticlimactic fight. But actually, now that we have a replay... So you, and me. So they have like very low health. You have this health. Yeah, gotta get out of the storm, bro. Get out of the storm. Couldn't make it out. Gator guy's the winner.
You might say that a win is a win, but I kind of wanted a win where I pulled the trigger to get. So I did pretty well in match 63, but match 64, I got 81st place. So, am I actually getting any better? There goes my crown. In match 65 and 66, I got second place back to back.
Here I am looking for the last guy. Here's the last guy sitting on the roof. Here's his business turret looking. Both are right here on top of each other. Don't see each other. We're running. I still don't see him. Ooh, turret gets a lot of damage on me. I run for cover in there. Turret still shoots me through the wall. And then this guy just waits for me to come out of the building. Yep. And then finishes me off.
Nothing really special happened for the next few games besides getting 99th place on match 73 and getting 79th place on match 79th, which was the only time that the place number matched the match number. So that's pretty cool, I think. But then big things happened in match 8. It had taken me so long to complete 100 games that Fortnite changed seasons. There was a new ancient Greek-themed update that's totally old news by the time I get this video done. Parts of the map changed, my favorite business turret was removed, and my level was reset to level 1. This was my first time playing in the new season. I was unfamiliar with all the new locations and items, but I managed to get 5 kills and make it to the top 2. Me and the last player were shooting each other on our own hills, and then I decided it was time for some finishing moves. Is the storm getting close? Because I think I hear some thunder!
Oh, look at that. Almost missed. Exploded the tree right behind him. And they're like, oh, we're doing a lightning fight? We can do a lightning fight. Bam, oh, and that's it. Oh, they didn't want to overdo it. Oh, that's nice.
Then, in my very next match, I got 6 kills and was once again in the top 2.
Oh, I hope it didn't glitch out right there.
I had done it. My very first Fortnite win.
We both, like, have not loaded our guns. She misses. I hit her. She misses again.
Really?
Look, we're both reloading at the same time. As soon as I'm done, boom! Final kill.
It didn't really feel like a clutched game, you know? There weren't really any pro-gamer moves. We were both running around fumbling to see who could load their gun first. But we're not getting points for style, okay? This is a win that I finally earned. Of course, you'll never get to see how I reacted in this moment. The best I can do is an artistic recreation. I kept grinding the 100 games to see if I could earn any more victories, and for a while, I couldn't even get back to the top two. I knew I was running out of chances to clutch out more wins until I played Match 90. Now, this footage is a little corrupted. I landed in Rebel's Roost and started exploring a house that isn't loading in the replay footage, and I found a legendary gun inside of a regular old chest. I know it sounds unbelievable, you just had to be there. Then I talked to an NPC that I'd never seen before, Mina. I gave her a job to be my buddy, and she did something I didn't know an NPC could do. Every 30 seconds, Mina would scan the nearby area, revealing anything important. Chests, ammo boxes, even other players would become illuminated. This was amazing. I had a legendary gun, and now with Mina's scanner, no one could sneak up on me. I understand why people play with hacks now. This power is amazing. I think I'm in love. I got to the top two, but once again, I couldn't keep my composure and choked right at the very end.
And then I'm healing up behind a rock, and then I didn't even see him over there. In a 1v1, I was unable to clutch it out.
That's now 8 times I've made it to second place, with only one of those times I was able to kill the last player. After getting 45th place in Match 99, I decided it was time to revamp my strategy. For my 100th game, I was going to do something no other Fortnite player could do. I was going to study every game I ever played to see if I could find any patterns to help me win. What's a Fortnite coach? We can look back and learn from our mistakes. We can study the Oh yes, baby, it's spreadsheet time. My favorite time besides snack time. I don't know about you, but I had just as much fun filling out the spreadsheet as I did playing Fortnite. And this time, I didn't lose the footage. Now let's see if we can find anything useful in all these numbers. Taking a look at all the places we got, you can clearly see it's a little all over the place. When I started this quest, I was expecting to see a graph more like this, where I would start off bad and then over time get better and better, getting closer to the number one rank. But in Fortnite, skill level does not necessarily translate to a better placement. Sometimes you and another player land in the exact same spot, and the first gun you grab is a sniper rifle, and all you see is the magnified barrel of a shotgun, and other times you can make it to the top 25 without ever seeing another soul. I did notice that in my first 31 games, I was getting a pretty low placement, but then once I started to get the hang of the game, I would more consistently make it into the top 10. I mean, sometimes I would still die quickly, but it was less frequent. Now let's see if we can find a pattern in the data that would translate into getting a better place. Maybe the secret to getting in the top 10 is getting a lot of kills. If we compare the amount of kills I got each match with the placement, we see... Okay, I'm seeing a little bit of correlation here. The more kills we have, the better we tend to do. But sometimes I got 2 kills and made it to 79th place, and other times I got 1 kill and made it to the top 11. Technically speaking, you don't even need to get a single kill to get a victory royale if the other players are shit enough. But I think you'll be surprised to see what happens when we compare the placement with the length of every match. Now that's some correlation. The matches that were longer, we did better in. I think I'll apply this strategy to my 100th game. In order to not die, you have to stay alive. I'm a genius. Now let's shift gears and talk about every player who ever killed me.
Boo!
Here are all of their IP addresses, and here are their mother's houses, and most importantly, here is everyone's recorded playtime. Now we can determine who among my killers don't shower, and that'll make me feel better to losing to them. If we add up all of my killers' playtimes, we get an average play time of 301 hours and 37 minutes. Now, gamers, if you've played a video game for over 300 hours, are you considered a sweat? I honestly don't know where we should draw the line, but let's just say for the sake of this video, if you're above a 301 average, you're a sweat. However, since it took forever to make this video and Fortnite changed seasons yet again, we can check back in on these gamers in 3 months to see if the players we deemed as sweats do indeed play more Fortnite than everyone else. Some people played a little, some people played a lot, and someone even quit the game entirely after killing me. Now, I don't want to sound mean, but these gamers played an average of 50 hours and 6 minutes of Fortnite. I said mean, which is like what, 33 minutes a day or 3.9 hours a week? That just sounds like a nice Saturday. Now, what can we do with all this information? Nothing. This is just a reminder to set your account to private because people on the internet are weird. Now, that's all well and good, but which gun is the most deadly to us? Here's a list of everything I ever died to in the game. Looking at the data, we actually have a tie for most deadly gun, with shotguns and ARs both getting 30 kills on me, and the most deadly rarity being a pretty close tie with rare guns getting 24 kills and epic guns getting 25 kills. So we want to be extra cautious if our opponent has a rare or epic shotgun or AR. Someone write that down. I really wanted to see if there was something in the data that would definitively prove that I was improving at the game. I wasn't happy with just looking at the placements because they were all over the place, but I think I found something that does indeed prove I am getting better. My accuracy. Plugging in all the data, we get this scatter plot, which looks exactly like a target I would shoot during practice. But if we look at the scatter plot trend, my average accuracy at game 1 was around 22%, and by game 99, we're getting an accuracy of 31%, boys! That's 9% more accurate! That's improvement in my book! This abundant arithmetic is all well and good, but there's something we're missing. Which gun that I was shooting gets the most kills? Oh, you'll have to excuse me. I gotta get going. I'm hosting the... How are you guns all doing tonight? Before I give out these awards, I would like to give an honorary best assist trophy to the Business Turret. On record, the Business Turret was able to assist with 15 different kills. Unfortunately, Business Turret is unable to be here, so Porta Bunker will be accepting this award on their behalf. Alright, in third place, with 24 kills, we have Rare Shotguns. Thank you, Rare Shotguns. You're always there for me. In second place, with 27 kills, we have the Uncommon AR. Nice job, buddy. Keep up the good work. And the winner of the 2024 Fortnite Gun Awards are, with 33 kills, my eyes see the Uncommon Shotgun. So, going into game 100, we need to make sure we're equipped with a shotgun that's uncommon. Actually, this whole thing's stupid. Just because I got the most kills with the uncommon shotgun doesn't mean it's the best gun. It means it's the most common. I mean, uncommon. I'm sorry for wasting everyone's time. Let's just get back into the... By this point, I knew that I lost the footage for games 63 through 99. This was my last chance to get a victory royale on camera. It's do or die. For this legendary match, my girlfriend did something really sweet and gifted me a skin of a guy in an alligator costume, meaning I could finally be the real Gator Guy 333 and still not spend any money on a free game. Thanks, babe. During the first 99 matches, I would sometimes add silly little commentary even though no one was ever going to watch the footage. Honey, did you leave the chest on the kitchen counter again? But for this momentous match, I was going to remain completely silent. I needed all of my focus to be on the game. I landed in Zeus's Pantheon and immediately got 3 kills. A very close call. One more bullet would have done the trick. The most important match of my life almost ended with me in 84th place. So, admittedly, combing through the 21 hours of footage to fill out my spreadsheets took quite some time. So much time that they changed the game once again. they added a new item called the Legendary Banana. What does that do? Is it a weapon? Food items normally heal you, so why is it legendary? I decided to take the banana with me and figure out what it did later. After not seeing any chatter, I headed out of the Pantheon to a bunker opening nearby. I waited a bit to see if the coast was clear, then I made my way down and looted up. Heading outside, I saw an NPC. Ooh, I think someone's about to get a job. I couldn't find the source of the bullet, so I hopped into a sports car and drove away. But when I got out, I guess now's a good time to learn what this legendary banana does. It was over. My 100th match, and all I got was 16th place. And that's when I learned you can read a description of what an item does in the tab menu. 100 games in, and I'm still learning new things. But it was too little, too late. My 100th game was a complete failure. Or was it? You see, I had set out to play Fortnite 100 times, and after this match, I had only played no build 99 times. Remember, my very first game was with builds on. Are we really going to count that one? For one, it totally messes with the spreadsheet that I have 99 no-build games and one build game. So this next one, this is my actual 100th game. For the spreadsheet. I landed an old reliable Rebel's Roost to pay a visit to my favorite NPC, Mina. With her on my team, we were unstoppable. Inside, I randomly found a Midas service station that let me upgrade my rare shotgun into a legendary one. I didn't know you could upgrade guns. 100 games in and we're still learning new things. We made it to the top 6 with 4 kills. Mina used an ingenious strategy of trying to shoot them through the ground. I like the spirit, Mina, but I don't think it's gonna work. We faced off and I blasted them with my legendary shotgun. 5 people left. I healed up and waited for someone to appear on Mina's scanner. Finally, we spotted someone. 2 someones. A 2v2, huh? I tried to move to a better position, but a player started to flank me. Both of us started blasting, but I came out victorious with only 8 health points to spare. 3 people left. I healed up as fast as I could and then spotted another player. I used the new River Styx skulls to jump forward, trying to shorten the distance between us. I got 1 shotgun hit on them, but they immediately threw down a Shield Bubble Jr. No one can fire bullets in or out of a Shield Bubble Jr., so I knew the only way I was going to get this other player would be from the inside.
Dude, I am
And those shaky nerves were probably the reason I died to an NPC. She was the goddess of hunting, sure, but still an NPC nonetheless. My NPC was shooting the ground. Where were you, Mina? So, I know you were all hoping to see a victory royale on camera, but I was never able to successfully win one. Or could I? Remember my second match that was against a bunch of bots? Are we really going to count that one? I mean, I wasn't even playing against real people, okay? I think we should strike that one from the record, too. From now on, only matches with real people count. In preparation for my actual 100th match, I tried some meditation to calm my nerves down. Okay, that time, I wasn't doing my meditation right. Okay, this... That one was bullshit. They got a super awesome gun right at the very start. We're not counting that one, okay? This... Wait, other players can see minus scans? People know when they're getting scanned? You know, something strange happened in Match 100 Part 5. Early on in the game, as everyone was scrambling to get good loot, I visually heard some footsteps outside, and I jumped out a window and saw a low-life default skin running helplessly into a wall, holding nothing but a pickaxe. My ranger pistol was drawn, pointed right at the back of their head, but for some reason, I didn't pull the trigger. I knew that if I were to achieve a victory royale, that eventually this default skin would have to be eliminated, but I took pity on them. We're all trapped in this endless cycle of violence. To what end? To be the last one standing in a giant death battle, only to die in a merciless storm? Also, they didn't want to spend money on a free game. You know, I get that. So, I did the only thing a Fortnite player could do to communicate intentions of peace. I danced for them. They slowly turned, still wielding a pickaxe they could have very easily swung at me during my dance solo. And then they did the unthinkable. They danced back to a copyrighted song that I can't play. And then the other player got out a piece of paper and drew a heart. While we stood there getting notifications that somewhere on the map, PAX Player 25, Shotgun, Solo Spy 86, and Ginger Ninja 2906 eliminated Gaelic Gator 12. Oh no, a fellow gator. Me and this other player were sharing a moment. A moment of friendship. Of course, this is still a battlefield, and just like the World War I soldiers on December 26th, I had to get back to shooting my friend. I gave this default skin somewhat of a fighting chance by giving them a handgun and letting them take the first shot. And they weirdly had dog shit aim, like non-human levels of bad, so I might have just shared this intimate moment with a bot. So even though we couldn't see a victory royale on camera, maybe we could do something better. Is it possible I had been playing Fortnite all wrong? I mean, not including those first 30 games where I was definitely playing wrong, but maybe the real Fortnites were the friends we made along the way. I'm done with trying to win. My new quest is to make at least one Fortnite friend. And to do this, I need ways of communicating to other players my peaceful, non-threatening intentions. I need to buy more emotes. I need to spend money on a free game.
Babe! Can I use your credit card?
The only emotes available in the shop were these three dances. They're not really the friendliest dances, but they were the only ones available. So let's see if we can take these new learned dance moves and see how far we can get with the power of friendship. While all the players were waiting for the battle bus, I wanted to do something I was never able to do before. Dance with another player. So many times, other players would come up to me and do a cool dance, and all I could do back was the lame default dance. So I went up to this girl in a yellow jumpsuit and started to dance. We showed each other that we both had zero crowns. Oh wait, she's got one. And I think my dancing impressed her because she went from swinging on a cloud to playing the guitar. So, as first dances go, it was pretty successful. When the match started, I headed to old reliable Rebel's Roost. And the first thing I did was stock up in the gun room. Okay, I know I'm trying to make friends this round, but sometimes people don't want to be friends. I made a rule for myself that if I saw another player, I would dance at them, but then if they started shooting me, then friendship quest is over, we're switching to they don't deserve my kindness quest. Okay, I think that's fair. That's a healthy boundary. I headed outside and saw my first potential friend. I tried showing them my new dance moves, but they weren't too impressed. They started shooting me with the aim that only a bot should have, and I had no choice but to end their program. The next potential friend I tried to make tried to shoot me while I was dancing, and maybe I was unintentionally matrix dodging all their bullets, but they couldn't seem to hit me either. I decided to recruit Mina again, thinking that her scanner would be useful to help find other potential friends, not realizing that she wasn't on a friendship quest right now, so she would be trying to shoot our potential friends, so if you're trying to do a friendship quest, then don't hire NPCs. I danced on top of portable bunkers out in the open, but there weren't any people to enjoy my dance moves. And before I knew it, me and Mina were in the top three, and I started to get excited. Maybe a little too trigger happy.
This is just my heart rate, dude.
I saw one of my last two opponents, I mean potential friends. I threw down a bunker and started to throw down on top of it. And as they were backing up, they started to point their sniper scope at me. Now, maybe they were looking at me through their scope thinking, whoa, is this guy with a cool skin actually dancing in the middle of a fight? That's awesome. I'm going to be his friend. But I didn't give him that benefit of the doubt. They hadn't technically shot me first, so I was breaking my only rule, but I didn't want to give them a free sniper headshot on me, dude. So in self-defense, I threw some lightning at them and finished them off with an epic DMR. An assist? That would mean I never showed this last player my friendly dance moves, but they took a shot at me, so this is fair game. I'll admit, I kinda lost sight of the friendship quest. I was no longer trying to befriend this player because I felt so close to achieving a victory royale. She came down from a tower, and I finally got a good view of who this last player was. And I was filled with so much bloodlust and darkness that I didn't even recognize her. It was the same girl I met in the lobby. The first player I had ever danced with. The girl in the yellow jumpsuit. I don't know the names of skins. I may not have recognized her, but I think she recognized me. She got on top of a hill and threw down all of her weapons and started to do the same swinging cloud emote she did in the lobby. I still hadn't realized what she was doing, and I took a shot at her. Luckily, I missed. That's that 31% accuracy right there. Only then did I realize what I was doing.
Wait.
And I was disgusted. I had set out to make a Fortnite friend, and now when someone extends an olive branch to me, I shoot them? I quickly danced back at her from afar. Mina took a shot at her, but I told her to wait back and threw a portable bunker over her. I didn't want to count my chickens or anything, but I think this is my very first Fortnite friend. I made my way around the hill, ignoring the dropped victory crown. This match was never about winning some crown. My new Fortnite friend jumped down the hill, and I crouched down to show how small and non-threatening I was. For a brief moment, we were the last two survivors in a giant battle royale, and neither of us wanted to hurt the other. I didn't realize what my new Fortnite friend was doing. She was purposely heading into the storm, forcing me to win. Goodbye, Fortnite friend. I'll always remember you. Oh, wait, she's coming back. Did she change her mind?
Hey.
No! My friend! Maybe if someone hadn't hit her with a bolt of lightning, she would have survived the storm. But either way, she sacrificed herself, and I got what I always wanted. A victory royale caught on camera. Not like this! Not like this! Are you kidding me? No. Pretty poetic that the only time I try to make friends was the time I won. Not a lot of games have a fun free-to-play version, but Fortnite is totally that game. It's constantly getting new updates and is an absolute blast to play with friends. Parents can play it with their kids, millennials can play it with Gen Z, and everyone can have a grand old time chasing after that crown. But for me, I'm gonna keep on making Fortnite friends. And lastly, if you or someone you know is good at fixing hard drives, I will gladly send you this hard drive, and if you can get the files from it, I will give you $950. Please don't look around on that flash drive, especially don't look in the folder called taxes, because that's where my important tax information is, so just, you know, just fix it and just let me know, okay? Thank you all for watching this video about me playing Fortnite a lot. Now that it's all done, I'm gonna go play some more Fortnite. Are you enjoying the new season of Fortnite? Let me know in the comment box down below. That question will be relevant till the end of time, I think, so that's good. Thank you to my amazing team for getting this incredibly short video out in a timely manner. If you enjoyed a video game challenge video, let me know. Maybe next time I'll do 100 ranked matches of Fortnite. Anyways, don't really have any announcements. Be sure to wear your seatbelt. See you later. You know how when people get into a new relationship, they go through a honeymoon phase? Well, me and my girlfriend went through a is the person I'm dating a deranged murderer phase. When she first came over to my house, she thought my Nintendo figure collection was something only a psychopath would have. And she's right. When you've been living alone for so long, sometimes you just need to buy friends and put them on display. And sometimes you do this by turning people into lampshades or chairs. Luckily, I just collect hunky reptile figures. Gif doesn't actually think I'm a psychopath anymore, which is good, you know, because I don't want anyone to know the truth. However, early on in our relationship, there were some things I did that she didn't like. Like one time I was unloading the dishwasher and I was putting away the knives and Gif looked at me all concerned and I asked, "What's the matter, huh? Huh?" I don't know what made her run to the other side of the room like that when I could clearly just throw the knife at her. Yeah, she's kind of stupid. But she definitely got her point across that she didn't like me holding multiple knives and told me to cut it out. But I didn't know if she was a psychopath either, though, because there are definitely some things about her that made me question her sanity. Like how she owns a $2,000 animal mascot costume, but she hates sports. That's weird. One time when I was over at her apartment, I was looking through her freezer, assuming she had bagel bites, and I asked, "Hey babe, where's all the bagel bites?" And there was this plastic grocery bag in there, and she tells me, no, don't look in there! We don't have any bagel bites, you ate them all, remember? But in my mind, all I'm thinking is, hold on. What the frick does this chick have in her freezer that she doesn't want me to see? A freezer is not a place where you tell someone, don't look in there. You say that about underwear drawers and toilets. That's it. I don't know what we did for the next 10 minutes, because all I was thinking about was how many severed hands were in Gif's freezer. But then I thought, okay, maybe I'm overreacting. I optimistically asked, "Hey, babe, are you, perhaps keeping a surprise for me in the freezer? Like a birthday cake? My birthday's not for another 5 months, but that's the only thing I could think a person would hide in a freezer that wouldn't make them a psychopath." And she said, "Nope."
"So what's in there?"
"Don't worry about it." Do you not see how this looks? If the doors weren't locked, I would have been out of there. I wasn't about to lose sleep over this, so I held up the knife I had from the previous joke and said, "What's in the freezer?" And she went, "It's a dead snake." You had a dead snake next to the bagel bits! So fun fact about my GIF, she owns 8 snakes. Mm-hmm. Apparently she used to own 9. I've learned that snakes are a very low-maintenance pet. You only have to feed them once every 3 years, and if you cut them in half, they turn into 2 snakes. Yeah, so I have no clue how one of her snakes could have died. And another fun fact, snakes lack the part of the brain that feels love. They're physically incapable of showing affection. So your pet hognose would sell your soul to Snake Satan for 1 dead mouse. So she already has 8 pets that don't love her, and potentially her boyfriend too if she doesn't get rid of that freezer snake. At least my reptiles aren't dead in a freezer. I immediately start asking questions. Why do you have a dead snake in your freezer? How many other dead animals are in your freezer? What the heck's wrong with you? And she said, I wanted to get him taxidermied, but the person I wanted to have do it was busy. Also, there's dead rats in there for my snakes. Oh, that explains why the bagel bites tasted so funny. What's extremely gross is that the snake is still in there to this day. I don't know how long the snake was in there before, but it's been well over a year since that incident. It's honestly great, though, because now she can never complain about the state of my refrigerator. I'll have potatoes that are sprouting more potatoes, grapes that are getting me tipsy, and if she points any of it out, I just respond with, "Oh, you think my refrigerator's disgusting? Yeah, Medusa? Uh-huh." One time she said, "Ah, my fridge smells terrible and I don't know why." Really? You can't think of a single reason? She said, "No, I said the fridge smells bad, not the freezer." I said, "I will flush your snake down the toilet and give you a swirly." Now that's the sign of true love, kids. But for all I know, she could totally still have severed hands in there. After dealing with the snakesicle situation, there's some other things I've learned from being in a relationship. Apparently, there are rules and etiquettes when eating food, and my girlfriend sure does love and enforce those rules. I was taught, don't put your elbows on the table, close your mouth when you're chewing unless you want to talk to someone, and make sure you eat something green every once in a while. But according to her, there's more than that. Like, did you know that bagel bites aren't a part of a balanced diet? We were at a restaurant one time, pre-COVID, and when we got our food, Gif took a napkin and put it on her lap and told me to do that as well because you're supposed to do that in a society. I looked around the restaurant and said, but no one else has a napkin on their laps. And she said, that's because you wanted to eat at a Denny's. I didn't know why she was such a stickler for table manners until I went to her family's place for Thanksgiving and I stepped inside and saw 2 sets of staircases in their house. And it all made sense. Oh, they're fancy and collect staircases. Going to my girlfriend's home for Thanksgiving was the first time I met a partner's parents, and I tried really, really hard to get them to like me. Because I'm kissing their firstborn child. I'm in the house, dad's watching sports. I love sports, I lied. Mom's working on a puzzle. I love puzzles. They used to call me the puzzle king in high school. Her brother's playing Mario Odyssey. I love Mario. Oh, wait, I don't have to impress you. You suck at this game! In an effort to get them to like me more, I brought a gift for Gif's family. I got them a little baby cactus because it's small and prickly and doesn't like to be touched. Just like her. Ooh, ow, babe! No, no, babe! It was a joke! It was a joke, babe! I'm sorry! Gif's Thanksgiving meal was the polar opposite of my family's Thanksgiving. My family does Thanksgiving with two other families, and they all come together with mashed potatoes, and everyone gets in a line with paper plates, and we all have one big mashed potato potluck. Then I sit at the kids' table to avoid talking about politics. Gif's family used real plates and had candles, and everyone puts a napkin on their lap. I felt like Shrek at Fiona's castle. They had three forks of various sizes, but I still wanted them to like me, so I wasn't about to point out that it made no sense to use three different forks to eat a meal. This must be why Gif is so afraid of knives. All these cutlery options are bringing up childhood traumas of going up all the stairs. But Gif's family was so fancy that I actually didn't even meet them on Thanksgiving. My memory just filled in that we were having a Thanksgiving meal. Gif read this script and was like, "You know you didn't meet them on Thanksgiving, right? That was just a regular Tuesday brunch. That wasn't even a meal to be thankful for? Why'd we talk about politics so much?" One of the big political debates we have is that Gif tells me I wear dad socks. But I don't think she understands my genius. You see, if I buy and wear the same pair of socks for the rest of my life, I'll never have to worry about matching socks ever again. So I've already picked out the socks that I'm going to be wearing at my funeral. And as we were wrapping up our non-thankful meal, I got up from the table, and Gif's dad said, "Hey, I have those socks." So I guess she's right about some things. And her dad totally likes me now. In the end, as long as I make Gif happy, then I know her parents will like me, no matter what socks I wear. And as long as you're with someone who makes you a happier person, then they're a good partner too. Even if they refuse to throw away the dead snake they've had in their freezer for almost 3 years. Eventually, I contacted the people who made it, sent it in, and then I got it back working. But during that week while the tablet was being fixed, like, seriously, no joke, that was probably the worst week of my entire life. I'm being serious. Making comics and YouTube videos was what kept me sane. And that first night of being on my own and my tablet broke, I cried, guys. I couldn't even eat food. I was that sad. I hit rock bottom. I remember just watching Captain Sparkles and Game Grumps highlights all day. But then the day I got it back, I was a drawing machine. I posted a comic the very same day. So let's spend the rest of this video talking about these previously mentioned roommates I had. The first person I need to talk about is Isaac. He was the only one that I like, and he's also the only one I told that I made YouTube videos. Now, this boy wore Obey hats, he vaped, and he said stuff like, "That's dope." But you want to know why I liked him the most? Because he did the dishes! Like, me and him did the dishes. It wasn't just him, okay? I'd probably never become friends with him in any other circumstance. Just wanted to say that he was the cool one. I like him. Hi, Isaac. I miss you. I was looking at this post on the internet, and it was where the old memes are today. And for the after picture for the Scumbag Steve meme, it looked exactly like my roommate, who I'll just make up a fake name for, Steve for convenience. I'm pretty sure I was roommates with a meme. Just put a fedora on this meme, and boom, that's my roommate, Steve. And it was a very fitting meme, too. This guy wouldn't do the dishes, he always cooked this ramen thing in the microwave, and would leave this gross juice stuff behind, so then when I would go to use the microwave, it would get my paper plates soggy, so I would have to check every time before I used it to make sure there was no juice stuff behind. And also at night he watched anime without headphones, subbed. Anime has a certain sound to it, I don't know if you knew that. It's like normal Japanese, but really, emphatically. Luckily, it was usually late at night when he started watching, so I would just have to get to sleep before he started and I would be all good. James, why didn't you just ask him to turn it down? I did! One night, I went into his room and I said, "Hey man, can you turn it down?" And you know what? He did turn it down for that night. That night. That one night. The very next night. But you know, he wasn't too bad. He would spend most of his time in his room playing video games, and I would spend most of my time in my room drawing. So except for the microwave juice thing, we didn't get in each other's way too often. Here's actually a funny story. So when I was filming the part in the vegan video when I crumpled up Oreos over Reese's Puffs, Steve walked into the kitchen and he saw me filming this sugary vegan concoction, and I just said to him, "Don't ask." Okay, so here's the roommate that I hated the most. His fake name will be Hunter. He was the one asleep on the couch when I first walked in, and he was the one who had collected all those billions of basketball cards. Just basketball cards. And he kept them all in the front room. What's the point of having sports cards when you can't even play with them? I mean, I spend money on Magic the Gathering cards, but that's because it's an actual game that you can play with friends. What do you do with sports cards? I mean, I guess you can leave them in the front room of your apartment. Maybe one day your roommate might make a video about it, though. He left his Mountain Dew bottles on the floor, he farted in public, He'd always complain that Steve didn't do the dishes, but he wouldn't do the dishes either. One time I was tired of doing everyone's dirty dishes, so I bought a big stack of paper plates for everyone to use. But Hunter took the paper plates to a party without even asking me, and he didn't even bring them back. But the worst thing this guy did, one day he told me, "My ex-girlfriend doesn't want our dog anymore, so he's coming to live here." What? So this boy wants to bring a dog in an already very small cramped apartment. I couldn't believe this. The dog's name was Snoopy and I loved him. Hunter would put him in his kennel at night, but one night I was like, "Hey, Hunter, Snoopy can stay with me if you want." And then boom, from that day forth, I was the one taking care of Snoopy. Snoopy would now sleep in my room, I would be the one who took him out for walks, and I fed him slices of lunch meat. What was great was that when I would go into the kitchen and Hunter would be watching TV, he would call for Snoopy. "Snoopy! Snoops! Snoops!" But he wouldn't come. This dog would follow me everywhere. And then one day Hunter said, "Hey, do you just want to have Snoopy? I was going to get rid of him." And then I said I would take him. And then later that same week, Hunter moved out. He took all the toilet paper too. He basically gave me a dog. And of course I loved that dog. But we lived in such a small space and I was always busy with school and drawing. I knew these weren't the best conditions for a dog to live in. And I'm pretty sure my apartment didn't even allow pets. So I asked people I knew if they wanted Snoopy. And my grandma got one of her friends to take care of him. So I dropped Snoopy off and I've never seen him since. And that's it. The end. So originally I was going to make a video talking about Boy Scouts because I was a Boy Scout, but then as I was writing the script I thought about all the fun things I did as a Cub Scout. So here we are. Cub Scouts is something you can do before you're old enough to be a Boy Scout. It's not required to do Cub Scouts to be a Boy Scout. It's just if you're up to it or if your parents signed you up, you can do it. Now you're already pretty young when you can start doing Boy Scouts. It's why it's called Boy Scouts, not Man Scouts. You can start doing Cub Scouts when you're 7. At what point does it just become babysitting in uniform? So all you people watching over the age of 7, let me tell you what you missed out on. Unlike Boy Scouts that wear a tan uniform, Cub Scouts wear a dark blue uniform. Now there are 4 ranks to the Cub Scouts. There were some requirements you had to do to go up the ranks, but if you went to the meetings every week, you'd be fine. You didn't have to do anything on your own time. And even if you did all the requirements in the rank, you still had to be in the rank for at least a year. So basically the ranks were based on your age. When you were 7 years old in first grade, you were a Tiger Scout. The second graders were the Wolf Scouts, the third graders were the Bear Scouts, and the fourth graders, aka the really cool ones because you're the oldest. Actually, before I tell you, just guess what the mascot for the fourth and final rank of Cub Scouts is. Leave your guesses in the comment box below. Just kidding, don't do that. I don't care. We have a tiger, a wolf, and a bear. That rhymed. What animal is cooler than all 3 of those? I'll tell you. Nothing. And that was the mascot.
There was no mascot.
Welcome to the real world, fourth graders! There's no such thing as cartoon anthropomorphic animals. So if you did guess anything in the comments, you were wrong. I told you not to guess. The fourth and final rank of Cub Scouts was called Weebelows. Weeb-a-lows. Very fitting name. It goes Tiger, Wolf, Bear, Weebelows? What kind of animal is that? Apparently it's supposed to stand for We Be Loyal Scouts, because we talk like pirates. Don't worry, Cub Scouts, I'll make you a mascot for the Weebelows. Here, it's a made-up animal for a made-up word. Use it however you like. The Wikipedia page also talked about a bobcat badge, but I don't remember doing that, so that's whatever, it's not important. I can't even remember what we did as Cub Scouts. We would just meet at some person's house. I think it was one of the kids' moms, and she just had some activity for us to do outside, and we would just play. My mom told me that she was my scout leader for a year, but I don't remember that. I do remember we talked about bike safety, and I remember I fell off my bike a lot. I still got the award, though. Each rank had a handbook that said what activities you would do, and I looked on Google for pictures of the handbook, and I found these books with gritty, serious, tough covers. And I was shocked because the handbooks I grew up with had the mascots on them, and I liked it! The old books were cute and had pictures! You're not trying to get rid of the mascots, are you, Cub Scouts? I think it's funny that each mascot gets progressively unhealthier, which is why my Weebelow mascot looks the way it does. And I think I might be suppressing this memory, but every time we went up a rank, there would be this award ceremony thrown by the leaders, and I think we metaphorically drank the blood of the mascot. I mean, it was really just fruit juice, but...
Hello?
Hey, TJ.
Hey,
James. Do you remember Cub Scouts?
Yeah.
Did we, whenever we went up the ranks, did we metaphorically drink the blood of the mascot?
I I think that's just something our leaders did. Like, some leaders chose to do it and ours did, but I don't think everyone did it.
Oh, we had weird leaders.
Yeah, I guess we did.
Okay, bye, TJ. So another thing we did as Cub Scouts was go to this thing called Cub Scout Day Camp. I don't know if it was just an Arizona thing, but I hated it. Cub Scout Day Camp took camping and made it unfun. And surprisingly, even as a 7 and 8 year old, I loved camping. Really, Jane? Someone who sits in front of the computer all day drawing Pokemon? You like toughing it out and sleeping in the woods? Yes! Oh, yes! If you've never been camping, get on that! I'm talking about real camping, though, not this day camp. Cub Scout Day Camp was during the summer, an Arizona summer. And we would get up super early, like 8 o'clock, eat breakfast at home, and then you and your whole troop carpooled for about 2 hours to camp. There were a bunch of other Cub Scout troops that met there, too. It was a pretty big thing. You were supposed to pack your own lunch, and all the other boys had really cool lunches, like Lunchables and Go-Gurts and, ironically, Subway. I was jealous of kids with Subway sandwiches, and all my mom packed me was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on wheat bread. So before the day even starts, I'm already in a bad mood. You start the day sitting in this big auditorium, but it's outside. The leaders would tell you to drink lots of water, and they actually gave all the troops a bag of water balloons, and they wanted us to throw them at each other because that would keep us moist and not die of heat stroke. But water balloons are stupid because 90% of the time they don't even break on impact. You're just beating some poor kid to death with a bag of water. Then you would separate into your troop, and there was a rotation of activities for you to do all day. We ate dinner, and then we went back to the auditorium, and some of the leaders put on a play. I mean, it was a pretty dumb play, but I was invested in the story. But then at 10 p.m., you went home. You didn't even get to sleep in a tent. Sleeping in a tent is one of the most fun things about camping. And also, the whole time, we didn't get a campfire, because it's dangerous to have fire around 7 to 10-year-olds or something. But they did let us do archery, because that's safe. Then the next day, you went back and you did it all over again. And then you would do it for a third day, too. So 3 days of this. 3 days of people throwing water balloons at you, and you can't get them back because you have a weak throwing arm. And you're probably wondering, James, what's with all the complaining? This sounds like fun. I mean, sure, other kids probably had fun. I might have been a little dramatic as an 8-year-old. One time on the second day of camping, I was clumsy and I kept falling off the rocks that I was climbing on, and I kept getting all these scrapes and bruises and they really hurt. And then we went swimming. That was one of the activities. There was a swimming pool. But just being the little punk kid that I was like, no, I don't want to go swimming. So they made me sit off to the side and they said I couldn't swim. But then later I was like, I want to go swimming now. After you swam, the leaders told you to check your shoes for scorpions, and I remember I didn't check because I hated everyone. And you know the play the leaders put on at the end of the day? It was split up into 3 parts, 1 part for each day. So it was left on a cliffhanger. I wanted to go see it, but everyone else in the troop wanted to play with water balloons. And I never found out how the play ended! The next morning, when I was supposed to leave for the third day, I told my mom that I didn't want to go, and she had to tell the carpool that her son didn't want to go because he's a huge puss. And then afterwards, when they were handing out the awards, I didn't get a single award, because I didn't go the third day, so I didn't finish any of the activities. And then I never went back to Cub Scout Day Camp since. And that's why I hated it. This brick is alive. Not convinced? Well, what if I did this?
I'm gonna do a backflip!
That's gonna look so cool, Brickathy!
What are you boys doing?
Brickathy's gonna do a backflip, Grandma!
Are you convinced now? Did the brick feel more alive? I mean, sure, it's still a brick that can't move on its own, but maybe because I put googly eyes on it and gave it a family, you can connect with this brick, and it made you feel emotions. Convincing you that something inanimate is animate is the main goal of the Animator. They're nothing more than deranged frauds. For the last century, animators have innovated new techniques and styles to this medium, taking it from a spinning wheel that doesn't even use electricity to Spider-Verse. And today, I'm going to talk about all the processes and innovations that have brought the medium of animation to right now. But first, let's go all the way back to the beginning of film, when it was all black and white and people had to put up text whenever they talked. Early on, filmmakers discovered a very simple trick to make anything appear alive in front of a camera. And that simple trick was called...
You're filming something and then stop the camera and then move the thing slightly, capture a new image, move the thing again, and continue to do that a tedious amount of times. On the film, that thing now magically looked like it move on its own. And with this technique, you could make literally anything appear to be moving. Anything. But some filmmakers took this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters out of clay and a posable metal wire system called an armature. Now, animators can sculpt unique characters that bend and pose in much more believable ways. With stop motion, you don't need to hire a real dinosaur or giant monkey to make a movie about a dinosaur or giant monkey. I'm sorry you didn't get the job, Phil. You know, I just had a crazy idea. What if we made our entire puppet's head interchangeable? Now they can make any facial expression and mouth shape possible. We will have to sculpt out hundreds of different heads, though, but, I mean, come on, that'll be fun. That's why we're extreme, baby! Stop-motion movies are still being made and enjoyed to this day, and while new technology does help make the overall process easier, animators are still using the same techniques that were used on King Kong back in the 1920s, where they carefully pose out a character's every movement frame by frame. In order. Stop motion is a medium that I can't even begin to understand how they do, let alone make it look good, you know? Having a stop motion character in gravity-defying poses, making hundreds of different faces, is done solely to make the character feel more alive. And sometimes, to help sell the realism, animators will mimic quirks that only happen in live-action films. I always chuckle when I see a lens flare in an animated movie, because, like, where did you come from? There's not even a camera lens. Unlike me, though, who's always got a camera rolling. Hey, how's it going? Uh-oh. Oh, no! Did you catch that? Did you see the lizard eating a bug? Oh, we got him. Now let's rewind the clip and pause right here. This lizard moves so fast that the camera can't even capture its movements correctly, and he transmogrifies into an amorphic blob that barely even resembles a lizard. But do not fret, dear viewer. This is called motion blur, and it's absolutely natural. Fast-moving objects are hard to see in real life anyway, so this blurry blob only showing up for one frame actually helps sell the idea that this little guy is moving quickly. If you watch any movie frame by frame, you'll find motion blur everywhere, and you won't even notice. So how do animators who are taking hundreds of still photos handle this naturally occurring phenomenon with things in motion? Easy, they'll draw smear. Animators draw their own blurry blob frame to mimic fast movements. Bodies can stretch, arms can multiply. Basically, we can sneak in nightmares as long as it's only shown for one frame. Smears, while being very fun to draw, can look very weird and goofy on their own. But in the context of the whole shot, you barely even notice they're there. Okay, maybe now you'll notice them, but that's only because I pointed them out. And since animators are bad boys and don't play by the rules, they can make smears out of anything. Even in stop motion, we can sculpt a physical smear frame like how they did in Laika's Paranorman, which, if you haven't seen, is going to be your new favorite movie. Smear frames can be used anytime, anywhere. Unless you were an animator in the 1920s and 30s and you didn't know about them back then. In that case, you would have been animating something called... In the 1920s and 30s, animators were still figuring out some core principles of animation. Turns out there's 12 of them. Smear frames were used sparingly during this time, with animators usually only drawing characters with multiple limbs to show fast movements. The stretchy, wacky, and spiritually ascending smears that you all know and love weren't really used until the 1940s. Rubber hose characters have noodly, almost hose-like limbs that bend in all sorts of anatomically defying ways. Look at Mickey Mouse's noodle arms that I can now legally show you. The reason characters look like this is because drawing noodle arms and not worrying about anatomy is easier to draw. But like, just because something has noodle arms doesn't mean it's bad, you guys. What these animators were able to accomplish with the technology, if you could even call it that, is nothing short of dark magic. And the very same studio that made Steamboat Willie wanted to push the envelope and show the world that animation could be more. It doesn't just have to be noodly characters with Pac-Man eyes. They were going to animate a realistic woman with proportional arms that don't move in weird, exaggerated ways. And oh god, her noodle arms are moving in weird, exaggerated ways. In 1934, Disney released a short called The Goddess of Spring, being their first attempt at animating a character with what was supposed to have real human anatomy. They still had a lot to learn, obviously. Now, animating a quote-unquote anatomically correct human is actually a much harder task than you might realize. And that's because of the uncanny valley. Get more and more human characteristics, we hit an interesting point right here when something looks almost like a human, but is just a little off. Our pattern recognition brains start setting off alarm bells and go, ugh, something is definitely wrong with that almost human. I am entering fight or flight right now. So if you're trying to make something look as close to a human as possible, but are just a tiny bit off, everything crumbles. The Goddess of Spring was still good practice for Disney because only 3 years later, they released the world's first fully animated feature film, Snow White. Can you really blame Disney for going 6 times over budget to make this movie? I mean, just look at how these human characters are moving. 10 years before Snow White, animated humans looked like this. So going from this to this in only 10 years? How? I can't get over how real these human characters look sometimes. Almost too real. Well, I think you're old enough to learn about the dangers of rotoscoping is the process of taking real-life footage and then manually tracing over every frame, resulting in an animation with unreal levels of realism. And I say unreal derogatorily. You're basically slapping a cartoon filter over live-action footage, but instead of simply slapping, you're spending multiple hours doing mindless and tedious drawing. Rotoscoping is not the same as filming a human actor and then later referencing that footage, like what Disney did for Sleeping Beauty or Alice in Wonderland or any movie ever, because animators use references all the time. People had figured out how to rotoscope other people long before Snow White. So of course Disney, who was trying to convey real human movement, rotoscoped some shots. The problem with rotoscoping is that we start to sneak our way back to the bottom of the uncanny valley. Animated characters often do and should break the laws of physics. They can squash and stretch into weird proportions and be drawn in unique and interesting poses. And look, Snow White is still a masterpiece of a movie. The rotoscoping is fine, you barely notice it. It's good, it's a good movie, and it made Disney a lot of money. Also, how did Walt animate these shots of things reflecting in the water in 1937? What, did they put special glass over paintings to make it look distorted or something? Who would be crazy enough to do that? If you made a whole movie entirely rotoscoped, what you end up with is Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings. Notice anything off about these characters' movements? Look at how Gandalf moved just a year ago in The Hobbit. Now, Lord of the Rings. Hobbit. Lord of the Rings. Almost every shot in this movie was rotoscoped. And the shots that weren't used live-action footage with a filter over it. I'm not saying that rotoscoping is bad. You just have to use it correctly. A character switching from traditionally animated to rotoscoped is incredibly funny, and always will be. The YouTuber Joel Havier makes very entertaining rotoscope skits that feel like a fever dream, and I mean that underogatorily. And a lot of music videos get away with rotoscoping because, admittedly, rotoscoping is a very cool visual. Now, I wish I could say the first Lord of the Rings movie was a hidden animation gem, but I don't know, it's not on my top 10, I'm sorry. It probably made a lot of nerds in the 70s happy, but thankfully The Lord of the Rings has been adapted into many other forms of media, like video games, Magic the Gathering cards, and anime. Anime? They're making a Lord of the Rings anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings...
You thought Hollywood, California was the only place in the world making moving pictures? Japan's been making their own moving pictures too, and some of them are moving drawings. There are entire college courses on the history of anime, but you're not paying me tuition, so we're gonna have to skip over a couple things. A lot of early anime is now lost media because cinemas didn't preserve film back then, and an earthquake destroyed many studios in 1923. Some Japanese animators created shorts out of paper cutouts because buying thousands of celluloid sheets was too expensive, and they had some very unique character designs. And some Japanese animators took inspiration from Disney and made shorts that looked very similar to America's rubber hose characters. Then, by the 1940s, some major world events happened that got most of the world involved, and both American and Japanese animation studios were affected. But after all that, in 1948, one studio called Japan Animated Films, later bought out by Toei Animation, set out to be the Disney of the East, and they made cartoons about magical schoolgirls, and are still in business to this day and made some other less popular shows. One animator who quit working at Toei created his own company and made an anime based off his comic about a robot boy. Hey, I kind of like that art style of drawing humans with big expressive eyes. Let's do more of that. That same year, another studio made an anime about humans controlling giant robots. I wonder if that's going to inspire a whole new genre. And this guy was commissioned by American studios to make stop-motion Christmas movies like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Meaning Rudolph is anime. Nani? By the 1960s, Japanese shows started airing on televisions all across the globe, and they continued to make unique and interesting stories with amazing animations that were beloved by billions of people and grew into extremely profitable franchises. Like, I'm talking the most profitable franchise. By the 1970s, Disney was still very much the animated movie gold standard, making big-budgeted movies with family-friendly values. Which is fine to do, kids love bright colors and talking animals that only cartoons can offer, but some studios realized that animation was a medium, not a genre, and made animated movies exclusively for adults. That's part of the reason why the first Lord of the Rings movie was entirely rotoscoped. It wasn't trying to be cartoony and over the top, it was trying to be real and gritty. Animation could be anything for anyone of any age. But really, if you think about it, there hadn't been a new way of showing people moving drawings since those very early days of black and white stop motion. In stop motion, you take a picture, move a figure, take a picture, move a figure. In cell animation, you take a picture, move a cell, take a picture, move a cell. Everything's just been a series of pictures moved manually in front of a camera this whole time? Always has been.
You've got mail.
Oh. It says the entire animation and film industry is about to be flipped onto its head forever and ever. Yeah, right. I'm sure this whole computer thing is just... ever-increasing advancements of technology, we were able to achieve increasingly advanced... achievements, like putting a guy on the moon, and drawing silly little cartoons more efficiently. Gone are the days of having to physically draw everything out on paper and underpay a team of hundreds of pretty girls to hand-paint every frame. Now we can use this fancy new computer to render everything out for us. All we have to do is create a real-life mold of our real-life human hand, then draw 350 triangles onto that hand, then manually measure out the X, Y, and Z coordinates of 800 different data points. No, come on, this is gonna be so much faster. Put that pencil down. Now we just program in a couple of keyframes and we get... Huh. We still don't have the processing power to render everything out. Oh, I know! We'll just point this long exposure camera at the computer screen. Get these art supplies out of here. This is the future. And when everything's finished rendering, we'll get this! A whole human hand moving on its own without having to draw a single frame. This process is exactly what Utah University student Ed Catmull did in 1972. And while it might not have been more efficient than drawing everything out by hand, it showed that computers were capable of rendering out three-dimensional animations. This was made after we landed a man on the moon, by the way, so don't tell me this was CGI. As the computer's processing power grew exponentially, more and more filmmakers started seeing the benefits of using computer-generated images in movies. A decade after Catmull digitized his hand, films like Tron showcased characters racing on mind-boggling computer-generated light cycles. This might look... you know, bad by today's standards, but these graphics were something that audiences had never seen before. Plus, the movie takes place inside of a computer, so this is probably what people thought the insides of a computer looked like anyways. At the time, computers did a great job at creating rigid, geometric shapes, and animators used that to their advantage. Characters would still have to be animated traditionally on cells, but objects that weren't going to change shape like black cauldrons, could now magically fly in circles around our characters. Disney really showed off the computer's rendering power during the climax of The Great Mouse Detective, when these two rodents fought each other inside a clock tower and all the spinning gears were generated by a computer. Animators can now make any complex shape move in a three-dimensional space without having to draw a single frame. I mean, you know, except for the characters, they still very much had to draw those. Computer graphics were here to stay as Disney integrated more of them into movies like these cars in Oliver and Company or Eric's ship in The Little Mermaid, and then they stopped using cells entirely. Starting with The Rescuers Down Under, Disney no longer used cells and made movies entirely digitally with a program called CAPS. So if you ever wanted to own a cell of Joanna the Lizard eating an egg, that's too bad because they don't exist, which fucking sucks because Joanna was the best goddamn lizard Disney ever made. Don't touch me! TV shows and anime still use cells till about the year 2000-ish, but eventually everyone switched to digital. Now to color a frame, all you had to do was... So computers were great at making rigid, non-flexible shapes, but has anyone ever tried to make... A group of computer scientists who were working for a small indie director named George Lucas were taking this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters completely generated by a computer. Then a small entrepreneur named Steve Jobs hired those computer scientists and made his own company, Pixar. Yes, Steve Jobs was one of the founders of Pixar, and he originally created the company to sell a high-end computer powerful enough to render 3D animations. But no one bought the computer because it cost $135,000. So the team scrapped the computer selling idea and just stuck with making computer-generated cartoons. But they soon discovered a unique problem. The computer had a hard time getting textures right, and everything, including babies, ended up looking like it was made out of plastic. So the team's clever workaround this dilemma was to make a movie with the entire cast of characters actually made out of plastic. Or ants. You know, people don't know what ants are supposed to look like. It's fine. Pixar continued to develop new processes to get the computer to generate unique textures and lighting, like simulating human hair or fur, or lighting things in such a way to make everything appear underwater. No other studio was pioneering computer-generated images like Pixar was. And then in 2006, Disney bought Pixar. But I don't think Steve was too upset because 1 year later, he achieved his dream of selling a high-end computer. This time being a little more affordable. A little. Now, I want to squash any misconception that computers do all the animating. Animators still have to manually pose a character's body and facial expression off of a character's... build a complex system of nodes and bones that let them manually pose a character into any position possible. It's kind of like a digital stop-motion puppet, or an actual puppet without any of the strings. All CG characters are just their own complicated version of Pinocchio. Using character rigs is really the only way of animating things in three dimensions. But it's not like we can use rigs in 2D animation. Here in the second dimension, we don't have a fancy Z-axis. 2D animation can only be done by hand-drawing 24 new images every second. Except we don't, I lied. Even all the way back when characters were animated with paper and cells, animators wouldn't draw a whole new frame every frame. Usually, they would animate pieces of a character and paint each piece on its own cell. You remember Robin, they only drew one body and five different heads. But because cells are a physical object that get harder to handle the more you have, animators could only break a character up into two or three different pieces. But now, thanks to the computer, we can break up a character into as many pieces as we'd like four, or five, or 173! Have you ever played around with the free and revolutionary animation software Pivot Stick Figure Animator? If you're the type of person that says, "Oh, I suck at drawing. I can't even draw stick figures," then you're gonna love this program. On Pivot, you're given a pre-made stick figure or horse that have these joints that can be posed however you like. Each of these stick figure's limbs are just individual pieces that are connected in such a way that make it look like a stick figure. So to make these animations, we're not really drawing anything, we're just manually posing out a character like a digital puppeteer. I wasn't saying you can make a rig out of 173 pieces just to be funny. Because that's how many pieces I'm made out of. That's right, me! Even I'm a rig! And can I tell you a secret? Most TV shows use rigs too. Of course, hand-drawn traditional animation is still used to make these shows. It's not a lost art form or anything. But rigs are super useful at making still pretty high-quality levels of animation, but at a much cheaper cost. And as we all know, TV animation has to create more animation per budget. But maybe rig animation still isn't as cost-effective as you'd like. And maybe you're not a fan of the complicated puppet look, and you want something that looks more human. Well, there's one more animation process we can try, called motion. An actor inside one of these dorky ping-pong suits, a computer can pinpoint and record that actor's exact movements. Now we can take those movements, slap a cartoon character's model over it, and we get an animation that looks like... shit. Motion capture is the rotoscoping of 3D animation. It cuts costs, but the results are too human, and we're back at the bottom of the uncanny valley. That's why the kids from the Polar Express look so nightmarish, because they are following the exact movements of Tom Hanks. Yes, Tom Hanks, the adult man, did some motion capture for the small, nameless hero boy from the Polar Express. There's probably a reason we haven't made a fully motion capture cartoon in over 10 years. Because it looks weird. But I mean, that didn't stop one of these movies from winning an Oscar in animation. And before you ask, no, it wasn't Monster House or Tintin. It was Mars Needs Moms. Duh. Just like rotoscoping, motion capture can be used correctly. Computer-generated characters acting side-by-side real human actors look decent. It's not that jarring that these creatures who exist in a live-action world are moving just like live-action people. And let's not forget all the VTubers who use motion capture technology to bring their jiggly assets to life. No matter what method someone uses to try and convince you that something else is alive, I think is incredibly cool, and I hope you think it's cool too. But maybe you don't think it's cool, and you don't care about animation, and you just put this video on in the background while you were cleaning. That's totally fine, I do that all the time. I just like learning about how all of my favorite animated pieces of media get created, because it's not always the same process. And I think it's great that new technology is allowing anyone to express themselves in whatever way possible. A person expressing themselves. Those are the three key words here. From the big studios that are just now pioneering new and interesting styles with digital animation, to the indie studios that have access to incredible technology which allow anyone working from their bedrooms in their pajamas to create some truly masterpieces of animation. So, if you're the type of person that likes to trick people into thinking that something is alive, then you deserve all the respect in the world. In fact, here are some cool people that made the animation in this video possible. Hello, you just made it to the end of this video. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm still trying to figure out this VTuber model, so I'm over-enunciating my words. The technology behind this is beyond my comprehension. If you're still deciding what to get for the holidays, then great news. We have mystery boxes over on my website, so you can leave the deciding up to us. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm gonna go take a nap. Are you still watching? Oh yeah, she's coming back.
Starting ninth grade was it's not my best work, but I think it's funny. But there was a teacher walking by who didn't think it was that funny. It was a middle school teacher, so we've never seen her before. And she asks us, "Hey, do you two know the school's policy on PDA? And my sister responds with, "Yep," and starts to walk away. Oh, I'm not done. The teacher then began to give us a lecture about why we have to keep our feelings for each other outside of school. She said stuff like, "I know you're both young and in love," and, "But your hormones are all out of whack, and now is not a time to be going steady with someone." So apparently this teacher saw us sit next to each other in classes, walk with each other in the hallway, and eat lunch together, and naturally assumed that we were madly in love. Me and Faith looked at each other, and we were both thinking, do we tell her? You know, we probably should have, but we didn't want to make the teacher feel awkward or anything, so we just kept her mouth shut.
I don't go outside that much. Ergo, I don't see people that much. Ergo, I don't get recognized in public that much. Now you might
might think, James, really? You get recognized? But you're just some college dropout sitting in a closet right now making cartoons on the internet. People recognize you and talk to you and ask for your autograph? Yeah, I thought the same thing. I don't even show my face that much in my videos, so I don't know how people remembered what I looked like. When I first started drawing comics 4 years ago, I was never expecting that later people would be coming up to me and nervously asking me to write my name down on a piece of paper. Now, can I just talk about this? I don't have a signature, and if I'm going to be signing things, I really should start thinking about getting one. I signed 6,000 cards, and on all of them, I just wrote James and put a little smiley face. I probably wrote my name out more times that week than I did my entire life. Also, another thing, I have terrible handwriting. You'd think since I'm good at drawing cartoon characters, I should be good at drawing letters of the alphabet. Whenever I sign something, I always have to warn my fans, I'm really sorry, I have bad handwriting. And they always say the same thing, it's fine. No, it's not fine. I'm about to ruin whatever this pen touches. I don't get recognized nearly as many times as you might think. Like, I can go to the grocery store and not get recognized at all. Although, I am noticing that I get weird looks from kids now. I don't know if that's because of YouTube, though. But if you do see me out in the wild, then by all means, come up to me and say hi. Even if you're not sure it's me, still come up and ask. Even if I'm on my phone, just slap it out of my hand and I'll say, dude, what the heck? And then you say, the odd one's out, and I'll say, maybe. I'm a pretty chill guy, okay? The only time I can think of it not being okay to come up and talk to me is if I'm asleep. Don't wake me up, guys. One time I was at the dollar store, not a proud moment in my life, and later I went home and someone on Twitter asked, hey, were you just at the dollar store at this address? And I said, maybe. Another time I was at Chipotle, and I know in a previous video I said, hashtag boycott Chipotle because he didn't hire James like 3 years ago. But I'm a weak man. I might have to call off the boycott. So anyway, I'm standing in line to get a burrito, and I see a girl sitting down in the chairs looking at her phone, and she sort of looked like a girl that I went to high school with. Is that Rachel? I didn't say anything though. I got my food and as I was about to leave, I glanced back at the girl and she was looking at me. We both had that look in our eye like, yeah, we know each other. So I went over to her and I said, hi Rachel, are you James from The Odd Ones Out? You didn't go to high school with her. Okay, well I'm gonna go now. Good luck on your own. Yeah, I am. What's your name? Maria? My name's James. You already knew that. If you're watching, Maria, when I saw you, I thought we went to high school together. You looked like someone who was on my improv team. So I recently went to PAX South with my friend Eugene. That's not his real name. I asked him if he was okay with me saying his real name in this video. He said he was fine with it, but I think calling him Eugene would be funnier. If you don't know what PAX is, it's basically Comic-Con, but only for games. They have card games and board games, but it's mostly video games. I've known Eugene for about a year now, but I've only ever talked to him over the internet. One day he asked, hey, do you want to go to PAX South with me? It's in my hometown. And I said, sure, because I think that's what friends do. I'm going to leave out a lot of details about what I did at PAX because I think that can be a video all by itself. But just traveling there, I was recognized. I got on the airplane to go to Texas and this girl and her mom sat next to me. And I noticed that the girl's iPad wallpaper is Markiplier and Jacksepticeye. Part of me wanted to say, oh, so you watch YouTube videos? Do you know me? But that's a tacky thing to say. I thought if she knew me, she'll say something. Don't start off conversations like that. We went the whole flight without saying anything to each other, and then when we landed, Mom said to me, hey, my daughter thinks you make YouTube videos. Maybe. On Friday, Eugene had to go to classes before PAX, so I went with him just so I could go straight to the convention. One of his classes was in a computer lab. I sat down next to Eugene's friend, and the computer was already logged on, so I was worried that I might be stealing someone else's spot. Then some other guy walks into class, and he looks at me and goes, whoa. And I said, oh, is this your spot? You're the odd ones out. Maybe. I didn't know him, but he knew me. Which is weird to think about. Of all the places you'd expect to meet a YouTuber, your computer lab wouldn't be one of them. I started messing around on Microsoft Paint. I wasn't paying attention to the teacher. I drew a landscape with a horse. It was beautiful. And then I drew my cartoon character with a mouse. Also, side note, this is why you don't draw with a mouse, kids. And Eugene's friend saw it and said, hey, that looks like a YouTuber my brother watches. And I said, huh. Weird. And then I went to PAX, I got recognized a lot there. I almost got kicked out because of all the people who recognized me were causing a fire hazard. After PAX was over, I went to the airport to go home. I got recognized by another kid who didn't even go to PAX, and also apparently another person recognized me and took this stalkerish photo and tweeted it to me. You could have said, hey, I was just playing on my DS. I wasn't doing anything important. And then while I was making this video, I got recognized again at Target. Not including VidCon packs in the junior high that I tutor at sometimes, those were all the times that I got recognized. That I remember. At PAX, there is this boy who came up to me and said, you at the bed until you are 8 years old. He was bringing up a joke in the peeing video where I said if we ever meet each other in real life, you're not allowed to bring it up. But the kid was saying it obviously as a joke. I knew he was messing around with me, so I laughed and I pushed him away like, eh, get out of here, you knucklehead. But then later I was thinking, I probably pushed that kid a little too hard. I hope I didn't make a bad first impression. So, if I pushed you at PAX, I was doing it in a loving manner. In conclusion, if you see me out in public, don't be afraid to come up to me and say, hey James, you left your house. Good job. I'm a pretty normal person.
I hate you!
Oh! Well, next time, don't steal my Monopoly!
Ariana, give James your $200 you landed on his property.
No! He's in jail! I'm not gonna give money to a criminal! That's not how you...
Mommy, why is brother screaming?
Shut the f*** up, Sally. You don't get to talk after stealing my last railroad! I wish I was never born! Me too! You think I wanted this?
Hi. What you all just witnessed is the phenomenon known as Family Game Night. Family Game Night plays an important role in the house.